Here we go. And really, I need to do this for Washington, so I'm going to bring this chart up here for Brewster.
No, I'm sorry. All right, so here's our winter solstice chart for Brewster. I'm going to right-click on that. I'm going to edit that chart data. I'm going to change this over to Washington. D.C. And we can say OK because it is Eastern time. This will work just fine. Oops, I forgot to change the name. Edit that again. This is now for Wash D.C. And we hit OK. And we're going to drag this over here and save it. And it's now saved. And let's put this chart now. I'm looking at this chart for Washington, D.C. at the same time you guys are. I have been working with this horoscope. I've been working with this horoscope for a while now, working with you guys natally and that sort of stuff. I know pretty much the combinations going on to it, but I haven't applied it to Washington because it's this way it'll be fresh.
No, PMP.
We'll get the PMP. One thing at a time.
No, I just was curious.
We will get
the PMP. I'm trying very fast to recall because I just only wondered. Then you know that because I'm feeling that.
We'll get those PMPs.
I'm going with solar fire and I can't get my cartwheels to work.
All right. First things first.
Let me
just place it somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Except, of course, what's going to happen is we're going to pick up white noise.
I know. I guess on the floor here is about the best spot, like right over here.
Okay. I think it'll record me all right?
Yeah, I'm trying to get
I'm
it away from the noise
too.
Of that. So that
I'm recording you, too.
Oh, good. Okay. All right, so looking at this horoscope in general, we're going to be working with this world chart. Now, we've got to go back in a little bit back in time, and we go back to the year 2000. If you guys recall the solstice talk in the year 2000, right after the election, everybody's trying to predict the election and stuff like that. And I was talking with Sam Crawford, Arch Crawford, hot and heavy at that point in time. He's got very good insight. He's the gold guy, the financial guy, and he has great insight into planetary combinations. The guy can just sort of pick them out, you know. And we're both going back and forth, and it was like, well, gee, what's going on? Is all this Kronos Mars stuff happening with these stations, the 28 degrees of Sagittarius, and all this other stuff? And we're going back and forth about it, and we were like, well, look, a military coup is occurring in this country, you know. And then at that time, the news came out about the Florida election that they had all these ballots from overseas. Which, oh, this must be what's going to sway the election. It's going to be these military ballots from overseas and stuff like that. But no, we were right in our first assessment. Essentially, the United States apparently went into a military coup of some sort, or at least a militaristic hawkish group took over in this country at that point in time. They got their buddies in the Supreme Court to rule against Florida. No matter how the counts would have come out, it was just so darn corrupt down there that it could have been fought forever. So from the Supreme Court's point of view, they were heading off a larger constitutional crisis. But these things had happened before in the United States. One of the first elections of Jefferson versus Adams was hotly contested and had to be decided by the Senate in the United States. Presidents routinely lose the popular vote and become president due to the Electoral College. Why was this one so special? Why did this one have to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court to avert a larger crisis? Somebody else had their hands in the pie. So at that point in time, I got very nervous, and I was on my journeys and stuff like that down south. And doing these series of talks down in New Jersey and New York was killing me. Literally, physically. I just could not keep up with it. And I came back in 2001 having analyzed prophecies and things of that nature that I had made and recorded in the 70s and bouncing it against the current time and came to the realization that I don't know if any of you guys remember my old Raving series from the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
When I was doing the Ravings from the Lunatic Mind.
Yeah, brilliant.
And, well, one of the things I talked about was the fact that we were going to have a great leader at this point in time, and my take on it was that he would be born in China and educated in the East Coast of the United States.
Yeah.
And, well, I was wrong. You know, it's one of the things that's wrong.
He lived in China.
He lived in China and was educated in the East Coast of the United States. And, the other part about that was the fact that this leader was supposed to be a real bad guy. He's like, essentially, we've had three majorly ruling periods in the history of the world since 1800 that were not very good for mankind. One was Napoleon. He was always considered traditionally one of the antichrists. Right? And why was he considered an antichrist? Because he had a secular government and went out and wiped out all the Protestants and everybody else in his own movement and didn't care what was going on in the church. The Libertarians and Enlightenment had wiped out the church, pretty much its influence at that point in time. So he was really the first, by definition of Catholic hierarchy, an antichrist. The next one that comes along is really Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini and all these guys. Really, it was Joe Stalin. Was in the final analysis, Hitler was like going out to a picnic compared to Joe Stalin. The reason Joe was not as vilified as Hitler is today is because the fact that Russia won that war. You know, one of the definitions of the Antichrist is not defeated. You know? Stalin dies in office, leaves no heirs, leaves benign bureaucracy in his wake. They're bad guys. Again, where is he heading? He's heading a secular country that has no religious ties to the Catholic Church. The third guy is supposed to come along, and here's the thing, too, is they follow the progression. See, the part that is missed was World War I. And the reason being is because World War I was a symbology where we killed the old world. You know, ever since Alexander the Great, the world has been run by large-scale kings and heroes. If you called somebody a hero at the time of Alexander, they would have ran away and hid because it was not a good term. You know, heroes were guys that went and destroyed governments and wiped out kings and sacked cities. You know, they weren't wearing a cape saving people from speeding trains. You know, they were very nasty characters, brutish. So from that period forward, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years here, ultimately, if you go back further than Alexander, to other large movements like the Sumerians and stuff, the world is ruled by kings and potentates and directed by the various religious groups that underlie them. Now, as we come into the 20th century, well, first we have the Enlightenment in the 18th century, where they say, wait a minute, what's with this religious stuff? What does religion have to do with the governance of the people? The religion has to do with the governing of people's souls, not their secular lives. Right? If religion wants to stay out of feeding the poor, well, then they can stay out governing the poor. But that's really what the issue in the French Revolution was. The people were starving. And the church, which was based on a communal meal, that's what the early Christian leaders were all about. You know, the early Christian movement was basically a supper club. It was a Greek supper club. Truly, I mean, you know, Paul and Peter would go to some rich, generally rich woman's house, right? And they would have a big banquet and invite the poor people over and this and that and talk about the Gospels and have a big meal. They'd reenact the Last Supper. You know, well, the church decided after the 5th century that, well, they can't feed everybody. So, therefore, we'll just do it symbolically. We'll have communion at Sunday will be a symbolic communal where we'll give them a Eucharist instead. This is my body, this is my blood. And then they cut the wine out. No, it's even worse. So the basic premise of the Catholic Church was the ministry of the poor, the meek. And of course, that has nothing to do with the Catholic and Christian churches at this point in time. I mean, you know, to be perfectly honest, you know, you have a bunch of characters who are running these churches who are don't want to kill some life in the womb, but they're certainly willing to do the death penalty. You know, it's like a real oxymoron because it just wasn't the original what the original stuff was all about. It was really about food. And this is what caused, and if you've been watching, there's a front line on right now that they're beginning to re-show all the time, but it's pretty fairly common knowledge. What's the reason between the split between the Jewish sects and the Catholic sect? Anybody know?
I do, but I saw that last night. It's like the Christians were against sacrificing people or animals or anything, and that got everyone else really upset.
No, wrong. No, the Jewish religion is based on very strict dietary law. It's as much a part of the religion as anything else, you know. And basically, they went up to Greek land, and here's the Greeks, they're all eating shellfish, you know, and they're all mixing milk with meat and all that kind of stuff. And they weren't going to change. And not only that, the Jews were the chosen people. You didn't convert to Judaism. They didn't let people in. It was kind of like, hey, can I be part of your family? No, kid, get out of here, you know. And the Jews were persecuted once by the Babylonians, and they got out. But outside of that, they were rich. Judea was the crossroads of all the trade between the East and the West.
They were the fiduciaries.
Yeah, they were the fiduciaries. Well, even before they were the fiduciaries, they controlled the trade. That's why Rome wanted the place. That's why Rome fought several civil wars there, because they had heavy taxation to Rome, and these people were rich. They were living the life of Riley, you know? I mean, come on.
He wasn't a poor carpenter.
No, he was not a poor carpenter. He did not come from a poor family. As a matter of fact, Jesus' brother, James, was the head patriarch of the entire Jewish church by the time, a few years after his assassination. So Jesus' family was pretty well-to-do. And basically, you consider him the Osama bin Laden of his day. Coming from a very rich family and then turning around and saying, you guys are all full of shit. You know? So, but his thing was he was still a Jew, first and foremost. And he did not have a ministry that talked about converting others into Judaism. He was talking a ministry that was very political for reforming Judaism itself. Just like Osama wants to do with the Muslim movement. He's a Wahhabi. They are very strict, and they believe that Islam has fallen into the cracks and is totally corrupt at this point in time and needs to be reformed, and that the Saudi royal family is the target of that reformation. All of this stuff has not been about attacking the United States and the World Trade Tower. It has been attacking foreign infidels sitting in the land of Mecca and Medina. It's really what it's all about. And that the Saudi crown prince and the Saudi ruling family is bad guys. They should not be taking care of these absolute holy religious sites. There's a real bad thing going on here. The United States is just a bunch of heathens across the sea. They don't even consider us worthy of anything. They're pretty bad guys in general. You know? So you have this situation back then. And you had this whole thing where you had the split between the Jews and the Catholics, and the split occurs because, first of all, Paul is running around converting people. He thinks it's a good idea. Now, here's this guy who was originally Jewish and joins the Romans, and then decides that he got the light and decided to become a Jew again and then convert everybody else to Judaism. And that got Rome really mad. That's why those guys were all pulled into Rome and immediately put to death. Because they were having revolts in Judea. These guys were rabble-rousers. They wanted to get rid of the Jews. They wanted to get rid of the Romans so that they could have their money and have their religion back and all this other jazz. Meanwhile, just like the Saudi rulers, you had King Herod, right, with the church lined up with Rome. Just like where, if you consider the United States to be Rome and the Saudi rulers to be King Herod, you have a very similar replay of events going on here. And nobody's really quite clear about the origins of these things. So basically, though, the Jews were okay about this for the most part. It's like, all right, you know, we'll take these people in. But this thing with the dietary laws really got their goal. I mean, Peter and Paul said, all right, well, actually, not so much Peter, but Paul said basically, oh, it's okay to eat shellfish. Oh, it's okay to do this. It's okay to do that. To the point where he goes down to Jerusalem and they read him the Riot Act. And basically he gets real quiet for a couple of years and then decides it was a victory to him. Just like some rulers we know right now. They lose every battle. You know, there's this big deal in the Bible, in the New Testament, about Paul going to the town of Assyrian and driving out the infidels, driving out the female worshippers of the female deities, essentially. Because Assyrian was a major religious center of the pagan period and had a continual church for 10,000 years that was based on the female deities. You know, Artemis and Diana, and the secret name was Tiberi, that sort of stuff. And what does he do? It says in the Bible, he went there, brought a big mob with him of some sort, they destroyed the temple, and they destroyed the statue of Artemis, right? Which was basically the woman with all the pomegranates, her breasts, you know, million breasts, and the symbol of fertility, all this other jazz. Well, absolute bald-faced lies. The church, the city fathers saw the mob coming, right, and went and took the statue and buried it in fine sand behind the city hall, behind the city administration building, and then they all left the city. And so this mob comes in, sacks the city, sacks the temple, and leaves. And for 2,000 years, the statue was buried, and it was discovered about 20 years ago. Brought out in perfect shape. Beautiful marble statue. Now, I forget which museum. It might be in the Turkish Museum. I'm not sure. In Constantinople. But it's right there. I mean, these guys lied to their people. It was just as much propaganda back then as it is now. So, you have this major split going on, and it all has to do with these dietary things, and it all has to do with these not really a religious movement as much as a political movement that culminates with Masada in 72 AD, which was the last stand, the last Jewish revolt, and the Jews get dispersed. The dysphoria really accelerates at this point in time. Now, the Jews had been in a dysphoria for quite some time before that because they were great traders. They went everywhere to conduct money changes, and Bernie and Phil's furniture store, and they put it open up one in Providence, Rhode Island, and they open up one in Connecticut, and they go out to Connecticut to check it out, and they leave Providence. Well, you know, the differences were similar in the Mediterranean, you know, people would go all over the place. But they got really dispersed after 72 AD. And when we look at the book of Revelations and all this other jazz, who was it they were talking about in the book of Revelations? Who was the sign of the beast and all this other jazz in the book of Revelations? Nero. Nero was sitting there throwing people to the lions and all that other. He had declared war on the Christian sect after the revolt. This was after the revolt. After the Jews were always splattered. And this Catholic church, this Catholicism is spreading around. And it was so novel to the Romans, why they liked it, because these people had real piety. They really believed what they were doing, whereas the Romans were just sort of paying lip service to the gods. I mean, you know, they'd go to the temple and have a big party at the temple, and that was basically how they worshiped the gods, and it was what it was all about. These other people, like, they're believing this idea of this afterlife and all this other jazz, you know. I always say to people, you know, when the evangelist knocks on the door and stuff like that, I say, well, look, let me give you a riddle. If there's a devil, a real devil, a guy with horns and hooves running around, and he's entirely charged, this whole thing is charged with getting your soul for eternal damnation, right? Theragos, which was never, by the way, talked about by the Jews, and never talked about by the early Christians. This is something that occurs much later. Right? But there's this guy running around with horns and hooves, right? Pan is running around, he's a devil, right? And he's charged with doing this. Now, you know this, that if you acquiesce to this person's wishes, you're going to be damned for all time and eternity in the burning flames of hell, or if hell happens to freeze over in the frigid cold down there in Antarctica. What could you possibly offer somebody to give up their eternal soul? I mean, a truly thinking person or a powerful person. What could you possibly offer them? Anybody have any ideas?
Remember, the devil can do anything he wants now. He's supposed to be just evil guy. He can
lie through his teeth and stuff like that.
What could the devil possibly offer you that would make you want to give everything up? That's why it's a riddle. Well, you see, I have a hard time thinking about it. I bet you the evangelicals would come in here and say, oh, he's going to offer you this, he's going to offer you that, he's going to offer you the next thing. Eternal youth, you know, all that kind of shit. Now, honestly, if you're not some stupid redneck watching NASCAR that's been thinking about who they're electing for president, right, you know, would these things be appealing to you, knowing that for all eternity, once you've given this power up, you're going to have to suffer horrible consequences? There is one thing he would offer you that you would take in a second.
What it is that
you
want, eternal heaven.
Heaven! That's right! He would offer you heaven. Exactly. Now, what's better than having a desert religion that promises everything after you're dead? come on, is there a better racket than that? You get everything when you're dead. Nothing in this life, it's all when you're dead. But yet, there's this whole business that Jesus talked about with this thing called the Holy Trinity, which is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Right? What are they really talking about is the soul, the spirit, and the incarnated body. The spirit of life becomes manifest because of the merger of the soul into the inanimate object, into this vessel.
Container.
Into this vessel, into this container. Right? That would tend to say that wouldn't heaven and hell be a function of right here and now? You know, I often say to people that it doesn't matter whether I predict good fortune or bad fortune in terms of money, material goods, or anything else like that. The real measure of good and bad fortune to me is whether you wake up in the morning feeling good about yourself and the world. If you get up in the morning and the world's a happy place, you have good fortune. And it doesn't matter what your conditions are. You could be old and crippled, you could be rich and dissipated, it doesn't matter. But if you feel good, you're doing fine.
You just have to wake up.
You first have to wake up. But if you wake up in the morning and you feel like shit and the world stinks and everybody should go and jump in a hole, well, that's hell. That's bad fortune. And it's right here on this planet. Look at anything more. And then think about past lives and all that other good stuff, right? Another big facet of the Catholic teachings is this idea of reincarnation, that you got to keep the body in good shape even when it's dead and moldy, because they're going to be reanimating the body at some point. You're going to come back and walk around on Earth again for a while, right? This whole business about reincarnation and stuff, well, all well and good, but what effect does having knowledge of your past life affect this life? Not much. To be perfectly honest, a real-world example is I'm the reincarnation of a guy named Carl Ernst Kraft. Not many people get to know who their most immediate reincarnation was, but it's pretty clear that I was this guy before. He was an idiot, and he was an astrologer in the 30s. He wrote a very good book called The Biological Traits of Astrology in French. He was a Swiss. And he really liked the Nazis. And kept going up and practicing astrology in Berlin until finally they said, look, we can't protect you anymore. They threw him in a concentration camp, at which point he died of dysentery in 1945 on his way to Buchenwald. But he was a white Aryan, so he wasn't going to gas chambers. They had him doing work. They had him doing translations of Nostradamus to drop on the British troops. So they would, and he just really was mad about that. He couldn't handle lying about what Nostradamus' interpretations were. But the point being, though, what good did it do me to know this? This is my life. I'm not Carl Ernst Kraft. He had his own life to live, I had nothing to do with it. And it was very interesting with that. I learned about Kraft and his connection from several people, and after I had gotten my degree in astrology. And apparently Carl had tried to get his degree from the Sorbonne in astrology in 1936, oh dear, and failed. because his father forced him to go into the family business. Well, I had already broken his trajectory by then. In other words, and you look at the charts, too, and you can see there was, you know, all these connections. For example, the distance from his son, Natalie, to his midheaven was the solar arc opening of his death day to my birthday. So it's 1945, 1951, it's a 6-degree opening from his natal sun to the midheaven. So it's like it moved to the midheaven and I pop out. We had all these other combinations that like just sort of changed a little bit. It's enough that I'm in a different situation. I don't have to deal with his karma, so to speak. So it really doesn't do me a lot of good.
Other than that you already were trained astrology.
Yeah, well, I was working in astrology in a different way, but it doesn't really do me any good because it's some other life. It's another experience. I don't remember that experience. I may have a dream or two where things blend through and I get a vision of stuff, but that's exactly what it is. It's like, you know, dreams are the crack between the worlds, you know, you're moving in out of space and time, you know, internally.
So if you died in the last life by dropping a blow dryer in the bathtub, you may not do that again in this life.
And that's true. That's quite possible, you know. But then again, you know, fate is another thing altogether, you know. As I mentioned, to me, heaven and hell is right here on this planet, right here in this life. And if this life is your life, this is it. This is all you get. All you get. And the whole point of it is to pick up experiences, whether those experiences are good or bad. It doesn't matter, you know, because on the larger scale of it, your sense of experience, what it is that you're actually experiencing as you're moving through life, isn't necessarily feeding your soul, but feeding a larger collective soul, you know? And so you have to understand, even at our level, we're in a serving position. You know, we have to serve other entities. Some of these entities are visible, some of these entities aren't. You know, and we're not very free. Astrology gives us certain boundaries that say, oh, well, we've got free will and stuff. Honestly, free will is inside your head. And it all has to do with how you interpret the experiences that are happening. And if you interpret them poorly, right, well, life stinks. If you interpret them well, life is wonderful. But it's the only place that it really occurs. Everything else on the external plane is sort of faded. Hans used to come from a different, my old teacher, Hans Zingerman, he came from a slightly different perspective. He said, oh, fate is like spotlights. So you've got to dance in the shadows. Don't get caught in the light. If you dance in the shadows, you can get away with stuff. And he says, you can get away with a lot of combinations until they gang up on you. And then you get mugged. If there's too many combinations, you get mugged, you can't escape, and that's called fate. He says, that's him, that was fate. You know? And it's coming from a guy who spent 6 months shooting people every day for 8 hours a day in World War I and kicking them into a trench. So, you know, that's all he did. For 6 months, he's hung out in front of a had the guys dig their own trench, line up, shot them, pushed them in, next group came, shot them, pushed them in, shot them, pushed them in. Got the Iron Cross for that. And that was World War I. So we have these things with these antichrists and whatnot coming along. We know that whatever Jesus was talking about had absolutely nothing to do with what we call Catholicism today. Absolutely nothing. Not one shred of connection, period. Nothing. Zero. There's no connection whatsoever. You know, we have a Jewish political rabble rouser and some other guys after his death made this thing and it's a business. He's got, you know, very, you know, a lot of land holdings going on there. And so we have this whole thing. So this whole definition, this redefinition of the revelations, which really had to do, as I said, with Nero, bumping everybody off right in their day and age. And you've got to remember too, by 60 AD the early Catholics were getting very discouraged with the church because the second coming didn't happen. You see, Jesus was supposed to die on the cross and everybody said, oh, that's it, he's dead. This whole business of the second coming and all this other jazz wasn't part of the script, wasn't part of the scenario, but he comes back. Right? Within 3 days, he comes back. And he says, oh, yeah, I'm going to come back another time, you know. And then when I come back, everything's going to be cool. And he goes away again. And so this, like, gets everybody really upset and flipped out. And so this whole idea of the second coming, well, they expected him back in their lifetime. And it didn't happen. And they all started, the early church fathers started dying. And this almost killed the religion right then and there. It was almost self-destructive because it was built on all these things. But things changed. You know, guys changed the instruction, changed the orientation. So by the time that 72 comes around and we have that great fall at Masada, we have the great last great Jewish rebellion, the Essenes are all dead and all these other guys are all dead, and the Jews are dispersed to a large extent. Everybody converts to Catholicism to some extent because it actually promised something after this earthly existence. You've got to remember, most of the people had absolutely piss-poor, miserable existences unless you were a rich, rich citizen of Italy. You know, if you were a rich citizen of the empire, you did good. But other than that, it was terrible existence. And death was hoped for. It was so bad. Death was, take me away, please. You know? That we get to 325 A.D., we get to 350 A.D. and 525 A.D., where the early church fathers, the early Catholic Christian church really had no center. They had all these competing thoughts. The biggest split was between Paul and Peter. Mm-hmm. You know, Peter was purely Jewish, and Paul was like this revelator. And as a matter of fact, you might blame the Roman crackdown on the Christians on Paul more than anything else.
What we have now is Paul.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Paul's orientation. He was a real idiot. But, you know, real idiot. So.
It's interesting what you said about the second coming because Olympus, the 13th Pope, actually set a fiat telling them, get a life. And that set the parameter for church folks being able to own land.
Right. They have to deal with the secular world.
Right.
If it's not
called the Montana Fiat.
Yeah, if it didn't come, well, we gotta deal with this world as it stands. You know?
And that was in like 179, somewhere around there.
So what occurs here though is by 325 and all that other did, these splits in the church get really out of hand. And you have a big split between the followers of Saint Nestor, who is the family of Jesus. This is the family of Jesus, or the Nestorites, as they're called. And they were in Jerusalem, and they were in the Fertile Crescent. These are the guys that were still left back in Babylon after the Jews left, and there were still groups back there. These were the priests. They controlled the water regulation. They controlled the flooding of the Tigris and Euphrates River. That area of the planet was called the Fertile Crescent. Saudi Arabia was not a desert. Saudi Arabia was the breadbasket of the world, right? They were the Nestorites, and they were much more like the Gnostics in their orientation. They had competing ideas. It was a pell-mell. It was more of a movement than a doctrine. And then up in the north, the remnants of the disintegrating Roman Empire, they sort of transferred the crown to become a pope. And you're up there in Constantinople, and the followers of St. Cyril have a big synod. And they call all the bishops in, and they basically said, all right, everybody who's with us, raise your hand. Okay, you can leave the room. And everybody else was put to death. Their eyes were put in a jar so that St. Cyril could see with their sight. And then goes on the First Holy Crusade. And the First Holy Crusade went through the Middle East and wiped out the Nestorites, which sent the Fertile Crescent into a 700-year decline. It was 700 years from 5th century to 12th century for the Fertile Crescent to turn into a desert. Flat out desert. This is the water, no longer were the water. You know, these were the astrologers, too. I mean, we were decimated in this as well. Because we were the guys that were left over from the Babylon that said, when the river, we made good calendars. The Catholics and the Christians never were able to make a good calendar. They had to differentiate themselves from the Jewish lunar calendar, so they went with the Roman calendar, but that didn't work too well either. So it took a long time for them to get the calendar stuff together, because they wiped out all the people that could make calendars, and which was us. So the Fertile Crescent falls into ruin, and the Nestorites get wiped out, and they went right down to Alexandria and wiped out the Library of Alexandria. The books being burned there were not burned by Muslim fanatics. As a matter of fact, the early followers of Islam, of Muhammad, revered the works, revered the Greek works, and tried to rebuild the library several times. But it was the early Catholics that destroyed the libraries. And one of the interesting things, I had a history of astrology teacher, a guy named Dr. Michael Hudson, in like 1971 or 72, which is basically what they did was they would go before each exhibit, right? Like they'd be like a steam engine that opened up castle doors or a battery and that. And they'd say, okay, if your pagan god is stronger than our god, your pagan gods will stop us from destroying this exhibit. And they would destroy the exhibit, and they turn around to people and say, see, what good are your gods? We can destroy all of their work. And they did. And the library kept them warm for 10 years, the paper, burning the paper. Some 10 years to burn the library books. You know? So they were going through the books. Up, into the flames. This is heresy. Heresy. That's why we have that, what is it, the Nag Hammurabi? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correct. The works that were found, not the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls are one thing. That's just really the record of a specific Assyrian group, which does constitute what the Bible was at that time. The Bible doesn't get codified for a bunch of centuries later. The Jews themselves were still in a process of growing and developing their own religion. The Nag Hammurabi material was discovered in 1947 outside of Cairo and Kesh, and basically was material smuggled from the burnings of Alexandria and considered all the heretical stuff. You know, if you read this book, you have to be put to death, essentially, that kind of stuff. You know, if you know what's in this book, you can possess it, but if you can read it, you're put to death. And it gets really bad that by the 7th or 8th century in Europe, if you could read the Bible, you were a pagan and put to death because of a pagan knowledge to be able to read. That's why the scribes were in the church, and the monks would be constantly re-illuminating the Bible and making it out of pictures. If you go to Notre Dame in Paris, right, there's this very classic cathedral where if you look at the doors and over the top in the stonework, there's the whole story of Genesis. Presented pictorially, and the whole idea is because nobody was supposed to be able to read. This is how they can do it. They look at pictures. And people were more attuned to symbolism in the pictures than they were, today. Even today, we don't catch the stuff that the guys in the field would catch when they would look at a picture. You know, the picture was, when you talk about a picture being 1,000 words, well, we have too many pictures and not enough words. This in the modern era, but it was just the opposite in the older era. So we get to this whole thing, and you have this church there, and they're sort of complacent. Every once in a while, a bunch of fanatics believe there's going to be the end of the world. And the last time was at the first millennium. That was a real big deal. A lot of people lost money in real estate because they were selling their holdings in anticipation of moving on and off the planet. When we get to current time, we get to the Enlightenment period, and the first of these great antichrists start coming up, right? The church forgets about these revelations for a few hundred years at a time, but they're real hot right now. And the first one, of course, as I mentioned, was Napoleon. But then we have this one of World War I, which I've talked about many times, where essentially as a collective, we did an Oedipal complex. We killed all our fathers, which were the kings, the potentates, the hereditary rulers, Even to this day, if you recall when Bulgaria, Belgrade, was had their big revolt, and it was run by this guy Ceausescu and his wife, and they took them out immediately and just shot them in the courtyard, right? And what was the wife saying? But you're my children, you know, you can't turn against the parents. Well, it was exactly that. I mean, these potentates considered everybody little children, and that they were the parents, you know, and how could they possibly turn against? Same thing with the last czar. You know, you read those letters, and they treat, you know, very pious people, you know, they lived a very deliberately simple life with the rest of the court that was gilded, so to speak, that was spending all the money. Very pious people, and again, they're complaining that how could the people turn against us? And all we've done is sacrifice for them. Oh, my stupid kids, you kids today, how can you be so ungrateful, you know? After all the sacrifices we did for you, we sent you for ballet lessons and all this stuff, right? We gave you bread. Wasn't that enough, you know? One time. So, you have this big thing, and that's World War One. And World War One allows, the European Revolution allows guys like Hitler and Mussolini and all to come forward. And the current regime is more like Mussolini than anything else. And Mussolini chose the term fascism, right? And Hitler never considered himself a fascist. He was a national socialist. And this is real important. He's not like Mussolini. I mean, they were not the same guys. Right. Franco was a national socialist, but Mussolini was a fascist. And the whole thing of the fascist was the bundle of sticks. That individually you could break each stick. But if you bundle them together, they're strong. And what did the sticks consist of? Was the government, the military, and the industrial complex. Now, what is going on in the U.S. today? The government, the military, and the industrial complex. Bound by a strong ruler who knows what the people need.
And right? He'll tell you
what. And we'll tell you what you need. Right? We don't need any dissenting voices. It means nothing gets done. You have debate and dissent, nothing gets done. We need action. And only a strong person can do action. We can't have no whipple waffles happening here. That's Mussolini's point of view. Hitler, on the other hand, was more like, you know, you know, he did the same thing, though. You know, basically, what was his motivation for walking into Austria, Czechoslovakia, and all that other stuff? What was the first thing he did?
We know that.
No, they wiped out the national treasuries and melted the gold down. Period. The first thing they did, they wiped out the national, melted the gold down, and then traded it with the Swiss. The Swiss were bought off, okay, during the war. The Swiss were not neutral. The Swiss were bought off.
That's not.
But he did give everybody vacations. He
gave everybody vacations.
Before
gave
that, people didn't have vacations. That was Hitler's idea.
That was Hitler's idea. Any time off.
Not that that makes up for anything. But I guess that's the socialist part.
And
he gave everybody vacations in VW Bunker.
That was the
It was Bismarck that invented the idea of retirement. And they said it at age 66, figuring nobody would live that long. No, really?
Yes.
Because the average lifespan was 47 years at the turn of the century. So if you made it to 65, the state would give you a pension. You did your good job for the state. These are all German inventions. They have nothing to do with the United States. The United States was, you know, William Jennings Bryan lost every election, you know? He was the populist guy. And then he goes and does the Scopes Monkey Trial, you know? And he said, and, you know, can't win normally, turn to religion. So we come to now, right? We come to this third Antichrist period. And I couldn't believe it in 2001 that this jerk from Texas turns out to be the next leader in the world. And it lets me know that these other guys must have really been stupid. But, you know, he's run by Karl Rove, literally. And he's run by his handlers. You know, Bush really doesn't have a lot going for him. He never did. He is a dry drunk. He's easily manipulated.
Did you call Wilson Minister?
No.
Oh, I was trying to remember his name. Do you remember? Name the minister
of the drying? Oh, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. He isn't drying. He just, you know, just
turned. I think it was Billy Graham, wasn't it?
No.
You mean the Bob Jones thing?
Was it Bob? No.
At the university, Bob Jones.
Yeah. But either way, it was a small ministry in Texas, and just happened to go to the thing, and desire to found a religion, you know, which is always the last refuge of somebody who's got real problems. So you have this guy, and I mean, he obviously is brain damaged, and he obviously is still an addictive personality. I'm calling this thing, almost choked on a pretzel, you know? I mean, you know, it's like, pretty stupid. He really is. The more you dig into it, you realize that the only reason this guy is around is because of his family connections and the fact that he has good handlers. Mm-hmm. And he didn't even choose his handlers, you know? So it's like it's a sad thing. And that always does make for a bad leader, you know, someone who's weak. And that's like Nero. There's a strong parallel here. Nero was really full of himself and was a weak leader, didn't know how to stand up to stuff at the right time, and made edicts. And
he was a Sagittarius, and I read somewhere that all he really wanted to be was an actor.
Yes.
But he had to be emperor.
Yeah, he had to be emperor. It was what a drag.
And then he would sneak out at night and put on plays and kill people who didn't like them.
It's all true. He was the first guy. He was the real answer. He was the one that capitulated. So, we have this guy comes into power. And in 2001, I decide that, well, it isn't worth it for my health. And it isn't worth it for me to be putting myself out on the planet like this. Given the dark climate we're moving into. Now, I've often said that the dark time started in 1992 with the Uranus and Neptune conjunction. And we're in the first world. I mean, we are the dark country. You know, we are the bad guys in that sense. And so, obviously, our standard of living is up higher at the expense of everything else, at the expense of the rest of the world. You know, we accelerated our secular thing since World War II, but now we're punching religion into it. It gets very strange. I once passed an email around the shop that was from a reporter who was over in Davos, Switzerland during one of the economic summits, shortly after Ashcroft was appointed as Attorney General. And she's writing like, it was a very different, you know, it's like she wrote her piece for Newsday and this and that, and then she was like sending this chatty letter off to her friend. Oh, guess what I'm doing? I'm off in Switzerland hobnobbing with the rich and famous of the world, you know, the real movers and shakers and this and that. And here's what they really think about us. And she goes on to talk about the fact that she went to a breakfast meeting, and before they started the meeting, they had to have a prayer vigil led by Ralph Reed, right? And it got the Europeans real nervous. Because to them, it was the same thing as having a Hindu have to have a religious sacrifice before their meeting, or a Muslim praying to Allah and stuff. And they're very secular. I mean, they've had two centuries of wars over these very issues that has got them very nervous. Like, we're no longer in Kansas anymore. Kind of thing. So right even then, early on, you had all this stuff going on. I mean, what is the difference between a religiously obsessed terrorist and a religiously obsessed country? There is none. You know, both have the same aim. They're both attempting to impose their will on others. Period. And this world has come too far for that. The end of World War II, the end of the European Revolution, by 1949, the world is supposed to be running on its own. It's supposed to be running where everybody is an informed electorate, you know, to continue to manipulate. It's like, kind of like, you know, you're 20 years old and you're still living at your parents' house, and you're really supposed to be out having a job and putting yourself through your finishing school and whatnot, but you'd rather let mom do the laundry. You know, I mean, this is the easy approach. The same thing with our leaders. You know, we're supposed to take responsibility for what our leaders do. But I'm too concerned about the Super Bowl, so we'll let somebody else do it, you know. Unbelievable. You know, I wouldn't even get into the fact that the guy that brings us, we would rather have a president who makes us impoverished than a president who makes us rich but gets a blowjob in the White House. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And this president won this election by scaring the hell out of people in the heartland, as you know, by threatening that they're going to have gays kissing in your front lawn.
Yeah.
You know? So you better not get these guys going in. But as I said, in the long run, it might be one of the better things, at least for the Democratic Party, that has occurred. So I got real scared, and so for the last 2 years, we've been just doing these social... ...very quiet, as much as I possibly can, because the times are going to get very dark. They're already dark for the rest of the world, and they're going to get a lot darker for us. So, first things first. Here we are at the Meridian for Washington, right? And you see that on this meridian, right? The sun is rising at Washington. Saturn's setting in the seventh house. Node is on the bottom of the chart. Right? Moon is at the bottom of the chart. And we have the Saturn here dead on square the meridian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mentioned to some other folks earlier that since September 29th, the midpoint of Saturn and Uranus has been the cardinal axis. We can look over here, we'll see it's still somewhat in effect. If I drag this over to here, there's the midpoint of Saturn and Uranus in the sky. Very close to the cardinal axis. You see it? So, this midpoint... basically, what's been going on there is that as Saturn went forward, Uranus was moving retrograde. They both stationed, and then Uranus began to move forward, and Saturn began to retrograde. And Saturn's moving a little bit faster than Uranus now. But that midpoint stayed within 6 or 7 minutes of the cardinal axis until December 13th. Then it finally begins to part. So between September 29th and December 13th, Saturn and Uranus stands on the cardinal, it means stress city. It means that everything is reduced to a black and white choice.
It's a pressure cooker
aspect. It's a knee-jerk reaction. In other words, everything's like, whoa, whoa, I'm stressed, heart attack. Right.
That's when the Electoral College election happened, the 13th, or is it the 12th, something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's beginning to pop apart by that point. But even here on December 21st, you see that even though it's popping apart, it's still within a quarter of a degree, half a degree here of arc. Let's see exactly what it is. 2937. So it's like 23 minutes away. Now, even by then.
How fine.
Alright. Now, it's going to move backwards a little bit, then it'll come forward again. All right, that's number one. And that's what this entire election occurred, this election cycle occurred within, was this whole thing. Number two is that if we take by the thought that the United States government went away in December of 2000, at least formally, well, then what's the difference between the Democratic and the Republican parties at this point in time?
What kind of I mean, you've got staunch Republicans taking the side of Democrats and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Is there any real difference between the parties?
No.
Yes. What is it?
Demo-publicans.
So there really isn't very much difference between these two parties at this point in time. The difference happens to be the perception of faith. Right, where you have Karl Rove monopolizing and utilizing all these religious guys.
Perception being the operative word in the sentence.
Right. It's a perceptive thing more than anything else. Because look, both guys want to pursue the war in Iraq. Even though it's ludicrous for us to be there. You know what I mean? And it gets worse. I mean, look, Philip, we invade this country because of this tyrant building. Okay. He has mass destruction. All right, or he didn't have weapons. All right, he's a bad guy. We should just be over there, right? All right, well, we got rid of him. Well, what the hell are we doing in Fallujah? I mean, this is the Iraqis revolting themselves, saying, we don't want you in our city, right? So it's like, oh, no, it's these foreign interventionaries from Jordan.
Oh, you guys that made buddies with Osama, you know. The bottom line is, it's like, come on, we got rid of Saddam. We should just leave. Let them have their civil war. You know, if Saddam was so bad, you know, why are we directing their civil war? Why are we making ground rules for them?
Now,
well, there's an interesting thing here. There's an article that you can get here by a guy named Stan Grof called Debating a Neocon. And this guy's talking about how he had to come back. He's a, you know, a liberal guy, right? And he has to come back and he has to do this debate at some college with some neocon guy, right? To speak at the Winthrop University in South Carolina. He gave this talk on like November 9th or something like that, right? And he comes back, and he had been down in Haiti, where, he said, while I was in Haiti, a full-blown incitata had broken out against the de facto U.S. puppet government of Gerard Laportue, and I had to extend my trip for a week, right? And he goes, so I'm sick, because I got an amoeba, and I had to get ready for the talk. And all of a sudden, he starts looking at the credentials. He could as well be a simple talk. He starts looking at the credentials of the guy that he's supposed to debate. And it's this guy, Patrick Lawson, who's the deputy director of Washington Institute for Near East Policy, author of more than 30 scholarly articles on the Middle East, right, has testified before congressional committees more than a dozen times, co-governor of the presidential study group organized by Washington Institute, which makes representation recommendations to the Bush administration, blah, 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 blah. From 1997, he was a senior researcher at the Institute of National Strategic Studies and National Defense, blah, 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 edited all these works, how to build a new Iraq after Saddam, the last Arab-Israeli battlefield, implications of an Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, dollars in diplomacy, the impact of U.S. economic initiatives in the Arab-Israeli negotiations, Iran and the Khatami, a political, economic, and military assessment, on and on and on. He just keeps writing all these books, right? He graduated with a doctoral degree from the New School for Social Research, bachelor's from Oberlin College, speaks Farsi, French, Spanish, German, Hebrew. The guy goes, well, my silent reaction to viewing this information was, holy shit, I've got maybe 4 hours prepared to debate in front of God knows how many people with this six-language-speaking, ultra-curriculum-vetted foreign policy PhD Near East scholar who had, according to the ads for the debate, just driven 22,000 miles around Iraq. The guy's got Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz on his advisory board. It turns out the person knows the vice president. So, oh, how am I talking to this? How am I going to win this debate? Right. So he works up all night, and he goes and turns out this whole thing, right? He has to put together a talk about it, right? So he says, oh, he might red bait me. He might just claim my politics up front and take my argument away from him. I can't get tangled up in minutiae. I'll denounce Perry early in office, so he can't turn it into a post-election debate about Bush's mandate. I can't claim that the war is about stealing oil, a favorite bit of nonsense among liberals that can be easily demolished. You know, I can't talk about the crisis. Talk about it as a crisis of capitalism because they never want to discuss this. Hit him in his Zionism because it's basically indefensible any time a couple of actual facts are deployed. And if it gives me any shit, bring up the USS Liberty. A low blow, I know, but I have to go there. I didn't have to go there, as it turned out. You know, the U.S. Liberty was monitoring things during the Israeli war, and the first thing the Israelis did was bomb it. It was our own ship. We just took it right out. Boom. Right? So, election campaigns, debates that are now thankfully passed. We heard about the usual point-counterpoint about weapons of mass destruction, who can more confidently carry out military occupations, who is convinced what allies can help carry this burden, what's been done about Islam, or who is more confident to carry about the war of terrorism. So I can't deal with that. I think these arguments are red herrings, right? This is the real argument. I don't believe the war is the exclusive product of delusional thinking of the Islamophobic clique that surrounds our current presidential mediocrity, as many liberals suggest. I don't believe the war ever had anything to do with weapons of mass destruction. I don't believe the very people who call this a war on terrorism believe it for 1 minute. And moreover, I believe they know perfectly well that the term war on terrorism is an oxymoronic insomuch as one cannot prosecute a war against a tactic. I don't believe it is a war to steal anybody's oil.
So it has everything to do with oil and more. The fact that, half the people in the United States believe at some point that a shattered nation like Iraq constituted a threat to the United States does not compel me for a moment to refrain from pointing out that this is a proposition that was and is idiotic on the face of it, and it's not at all unusual for half of a national population to believe something that is completely idiotic. I am not a conservative, and I am not a liberal, I am not a politician, I am not a pacifist, I am not religious, so I am not the least compelled or constrained to prop up the Ptolemaic foundations of any of these agendas. I believe that the war in Iraq is symptomatic of a much deeper global crisis, and that it foreshadows a period in which that crisis, a crisis of global capitalism, will manifest itself not only in war, but in a rapidly widening social destabilization, further militarization of the world system, and simultaneous economic and environmental collapse. Just in case there is a temptation to resort to red baiting to just avoid responding to the content of my arguments, let me save you the trouble. I am on record as a severe critic of capitalism as an inherently destructive system built on genocide and slavery, sustained by misogyny, racism, poverty, and war, and bound to undermine its own material basis through ecocide. I do not, however, believe, as some leftists seem to do, that a more sensible system will inevitably replace it. If progressives continue to whine and wring their hands instead of fighting back, we could very well end up with a century or so of anarchy and warlords in the context of a mass-human die-off on a ruined and toxified planet. Present-day imperialism is a real system, and it is currently directed by the American state. The war in Iraq was probably an inevitable action of this state in response to an impending and inexorable erosion of the very basis of American global power. The war in Iraq, while deeply and morally repugnant, is not a failure of morality, but the action of a system that can't help it. Republicans and Democrats can't tell you this. Pacifists and the true religious believers won't tell you this. Politicians, who will tell you only what you want to hear, won't tell you this. But I believe it is irresponsible to delay telling the patient who is about to die of gangrene the unpleasant fact that the leg must be amputated. Global capitalism runs on fossil energy, but the United States does not have to take oil from anyone. Every oil-producing nation, including Iraq, has been perfectly willing to sell oil to the U.S. It is cheaper to buy oil than it is to steal it with military action. The issue of oil is an issue not of production, but of increasing demand between competitors in a period when we have nearly reached the peak of global output. The demand is now at 79.5 million barrels of oil a day. The International Energy Agency and the Department of Energy predict global demand of 115 million barrels per day by 2020. But that is based on a rising at a 1.25% per year. In fact, demand is rising at twice that rate. The industry experts, who are not spinning figures to reassure stockholders, tell us with massive improvements in infrastructure and perfect political stability, the highest output achievable is around 85 million barrels per day. This year, China passed Japan as the world's second largest importer of crude oil. If anyone believes Cheney's Energy Task Force, on which Dr. Clausen served, did not review these figures as part of their long-term strategic assessment and how it relates to continued possibilities, I have a mountaintop retreat to tell you in Miami. So the question of oil is not a question of taking it. It's a question of the mathematics of it. And when global capitalistic competition continues to trend towards 100 million barrels a day by the end of the decade, when there's not adequate flow pressure to meet that demand, someone gets cut. And someone decides who gets cut. Establishing permanent military bases in the very region where over half the remaining easily accessible reserves exist goes a long way towards putting the power that controls those bases in the driver's seat. As a friend of mine once said, oil is not a normal commodity. No other commodity has five U.S. Navy battle groups patrolling the sea lanes to secure it. Iraq's pre-invasion production was around 2.5 million barrels per day, but even with heroic effort to restore it, production has not risen above 1.8 million barrels a day, and has actually been a net loss of 700,000 barrels a day. The U.S. military effort alone is calculated to have an energetic cost of 350,000 barrels of oil a day. Just keep our troops there. This is not business math. This is geopolitical and military math. What is being sought is a new foundation, a military one, upon which to base U.S. supremacy as the current one is beginning to crumble. And the reliance on a direct military violence to achieve one's national aims is not a sign of strength, but a sign of weakness I'm finding that there is a fundamental failure of hegemony. Hegemony is not direct control, but internalization of control by those who are dominated. Now, in 68, Richard Nixon inherited the hair-raising collapse of the U.S. Treasury's gold pool and the unwinnable occupation of Vietnam that caused it. Within the next 4 years, Nixon would abandon fixed currency exchange rates and the gold standard, then allow a 20% devaluation of the dollar that wiped out billions of dollars in U.S. debts to Western Europe and Japan. Since oil payments were predominated in dollars, and the consequent jump in the price of oil was a harsh blow for Europe, Japan, Africa, and Latin America, the U.S., on the other hand, owned the dollar printing press and was able to recycle the crisis via petrodollars to these regions. U.S. puppet governments in Iran and Saudi Arabia helped underwrite the system with their ability to swing oil production. This game of economic chicken by Nixon set the stage for the new method to assure U.S. supremacy, since the post-World War II industrial boom had run aground on the rocks of the Marshall II Plan of export capacity on Vietnam. So, the currency speculation that this abandonment of the gold standards and fixed exchange rates stimulated led invariably to a currency crisis in weaker nations. Whereupon Reagan administration, in response to Mexican currency crisis in 82, gave the U.S. its first crack at loan sharking through the International Monetary Fund, in which it held controlling polarity and exclusive veto power. This loan sharking was called, quote, structural adjustment, unquote, and not only believed 70 different nations white with an unpayable external debt, paid in dollars, by the way, these loans are contingent on allowing U.S. investors to penetrate national economies to take over key economic sectors. The system is now referred to as neoliberalism, but I call it debt leverage imperialism. It is arguable that a Treasury bill standard by which U.S. is able to force its capitalist competitors, who have lion's share of the central bank reserves, right, they notice they can never pay the money back to the U.S., and they have to accept the dollar is overprinted, overvalued at its current level for fear it'll wipe out the value of their own central bank. Look at Argentina. Mm-hmm. Argentina indexed their currency to the U.S. dollars and overnight went bankrupt. A country that was as rich as we are in terms of the per capita crisis is now as poor as the poorest Latin American country. The continuing growing glut of fiat dollars created by the conditions of the precarious Asian meltdown of 88, the dot-com bust of 2000, and for the real estate bubble that will burst next. U.S.'s public debts are at record levels, and if I should say there is a deflationary crisis around a falling dollar, the U.S. middle class will sink to the bottom like the Titanic.
It's happening.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
you forgot to mention wheat. Something else I saw the other day that
said there's not enough wheat. China
used to make enough wheat, but now they've started importing it, and so we're going to be competing with them, and the price of that's going to set.
No, we're a net exporter of wheat.
We're
net exporters of wheat. That means more money for us.
Yeah,
that means more money for. We like that idea. That's why Monsanto keeps control over the patents for all the food it's engineering. Now they can control farmers everywhere else because they control, the seeds are self-destructing. They give these guys corn seeds, right, with the BT bacterium embedded in it, right, which is really a Franken food. You have to understand that.
Your plan is hated, so
you have to understand that, first of all, we've been genetically manipulating animals and food in year one. Now, we can do it with more technology and faster. The fact that we're crossing pure species, like putting a germ inside a plant, I mean, it's like putting an animal in a vegetable, right, is real Frankenstein stuff. You know, it really is. But if we make a gene, say, that, modify a gene, say, that makes a potato bigger, you know, with the golden russet potato was the first one to get the BT bacterium, and that was made from McDonald's, right, make a potato bigger. That's fine. I mean, more people get fed. If we make straw, like in Sleeper, remember Woody Allen's Sleeper? Right, where he had the bananas as big as a house and stuff like that, and he's like going crazy. Right? Well, I mean, if we can make strawberries as big as a house, and we can do this, well, this benefits the rest of the world in general. But when we own the seed, and we make the seed self-destructing, in other words, the plant can't sow seeds, because the seeds carry carry a virus with them that destroys the seed itself, so they can't even carry it further. And not only that, they're getting international control that if a farmer in Mexico is found to have genetically engineered soy in their other crop because the wind blew the pollen over, they can seize the guy's crop and charge him a lot of money because it's violating intellectual property. This is a bad thing. So you see the hegemony of the United States going all over the world. You know, it's like that's not just oil, right, where we have all these battle cruises and stuff. Right out here with the wind farm, right? The wind farm debate that's going on and stuff like that. Right? I keep having a battle with Pat. She wants to drag me out to one of the debates. She doesn't get it that I don't really want to go public. She doesn't get it. But she wants to drag me out to one of the wind farm debates. What is the real thing going on with the wind farm? It has nothing to do, you have the one side fighting saying, oh, you get this pristine area of water, we shouldn't put ugly things in it and industrialize it. And you have this other crew saying, oh my God, if we don't put this wind farm up, we're going to be breathing bad air because it's coal-fired plants. Do you think that the wind farm is going to displace one oil or coal-fired plant anywhere in the United States? What is it going to displace? It's going to displace some energy production. Why? Hydroelectric and other renewable sources, because you can't shut a fossil plant down overnight and start it up again. The grid is not a battery. In other words, all the electricity coming in here, shining that thing on the wall, that has to be generated with the load and demand in mind. The grid is not a battery. It doesn't store energy. Right? So you have all these, and that's why we have blackouts. You know, some tree will fall on a wire somewhere and short out a transformer, and if the guy in the other end doesn't balance, the computers don't balance the load fast enough, everybody starts pouring their juice into that short, and the whole system comes down. It is not a battery. It doesn't store energy. It can only allocate energy. Right? And if you have a coal-fired plant, how does a coal-fired plant operate? It operates on steam, on turbines. And it takes a long time. It takes a whole week to get a turbine plant up, cranked up to power, running at the right RPM, to bring it online. To take it offline, the same process occurs. You just don't shut these plants down. You have to crank them back, shut the turbines down, shut the boilers down, and the process takes several days. So we have a hurricane scheduled to come up the coast, and all this and that, and wind farms are going to be generating twice the output. Well, they are going to turn off Brant Point. Right, they're not going to turn off the Morant plant over here in Sandwich because they couldn't even get it shut down fast enough. But they can shut the floodgates on the hydroelectric up in Quebec at the St. Lawrence Seaway on the James Bay hydroelectric power plant. Here, you just drop a sluice in and you shut down the turbine generators, which are turning not from steam but from the actual water flow itself. So what is it going to displace? It's going to displace other renewable sources, no matter what anybody tells you. Right? That's number one.
That's not what I agree.
There's even more.
It's a toll run on an auction system, and the oil is the most expensive electricity, so they will lose the auction, and they will have to shut it down whether they want to or not.
Well, then they're coming.
Not only that, but each plant has like about 6 generators, and they can just shut down one of them.
Now, the other part, auctions notwithstanding, Ray, they can't rely upon what's called an opportunistic energy source. Where, what if they don't bid for that oil and the wind stops? We have a becalmed day. One becalmed day, the whole thing goes awry. You know, it's not like California in the bid. So our contracts are long term. You know, that's why I've come to Compact to be able to generate a 10-year contract with Kate. It's different than California, where they were bidding on a day-to-day auction. Yes, there are day-to-day auctions going on, but they're in between grids. There's negotiations between other grids. You know, the next thing on this is, if you have that problem, right, with displacement of power, you have a secondary problem with it. And that is, it actually is supporting fossil fuel infrastructure. What's the fuel of the future? Where are we going in the future for fuel? hydrogen.
That's where they're supposed to be going.
That's where we're supposed to go.
And
not only that,
like
was
it, now.
And which is because they have a lot of money invested in their infrastructure. And that hydrogen is supposed to be little power plants.
Yeah.
Right? You're supposed to decentralize, supposed to be off the grid. You build a little subdivision, you put in your little power plant, your little fuel cell set up, it's run by hydrogen, the output is water and oxygen, and everybody's happy, and you're off the grid. Now, how do you make hydrogen? It isn't naturally occurring. It isn't like going mine hydrogen somewhere. Hydrogen is bound up with a lot of other elements. You know, it's in water. It's everywhere. Right? How do you make hydrogen? The general way of making hydrogen is using electricity to split water into the two components, oxygen and hydrogen. And wind farms are extremely well suited to this task. But that would mean that you don't site a wind farm where it has to be close enough to shore so it can send the electricity through the pipe. You know, electricity doesn't travel a long distance. It dissipates, it loses juice when it goes too far. The transmission line has to be used locally, which even lends us more towards fuel cells. It is not a commodity that you can take a piece of electricity generated in California and send it to New York. It will never make it. It will just dissipate into the air as it moves down through the resistance, the very resistance of the lines itself, of the copper itself, or aluminum. They use more and more of those lines. Right? To the light lighter. Alright, so you have this problem here where you have this whole infrastructure of this thing is built up to support an existing oil, coal infrastructure. And what should you be doing with power plants like this? You'd be putting them on barges and moving them around the ocean wherever it's opportunistic to pick up the wind. And then taking the electricity that's happening from there and split the water right on the spot and create hydrogen, put it in big tanks and liquefy it and send it back somewhere. That's the way to do it. But this particular project is cited so that it's exactly outside the jurisdiction of state control. And the minute that Romney attempted to call some rocks part of Massachusetts, they cranked it back. And why do they want to stay in federal waters? Because there's no taxes that they will have to pay in federal waters. There's no oversight for them in federal waters. The Army Corps of Engineers, the Corps of Last Hope, the only regulatory board, and it's not even the proper regulatory board. So it's problematic. The whole thing is problematic. You've got these guys are only there for profit. Take away the tax credits and they're gone. They're only there for the tax credits. And it is more expensive to generate juice out of that. Even by their own figures, Ray, it costs twice as much to generate juice out of the wind farm when they amortize everything than it does to generate oil and gas. And the only reason it's economically feasible is because it's going to come out of our tax dollars. And we're not going to get any lease money back from these guys. It's the exact same incentive that caused the atomic plants to be built in the 60s and 70s. The same incentive. You don't have to pay any money to us, and we'll subsidize you with tax dollars. And therefore, atomic energy becomes cheaper than oil and gas, when it never was. It was considered cleaner, but it's actually more polluting in the long run. Yeah, we have these oil.
Well, yeah, in the long run, though, you don't have to buy the wind.
No, you don't.
You do have to buy the oil to burn it to make electricity.
Well, again, like everything else of this time, what is the main characteristic of this time? The main characteristic of this time is a misallocation of resources. You have this country who is, for a small elite band of people, trying to reallocate resources to ensure their dominance and power, and we're going to what's called the South American model. And the South American model is you have a few rich people living on the hill, and everybody else lives in tin shacks at the bottom of the hill. The disparity between rich and poor, between the elites and the haves and the have-nots, is greater and greater and greater. And in this way, it's much easier to exercise control and to manipulate these resources around. And if you can get the people poor enough, well, then you can allocate more resources to yourself in general. You'll guarantee your own flow of oil and everything else. So it becomes problematic. You know, it becomes a scene where we're participating in the last strike of the Antichrist all the way down the pipe. The whole reason these guys want to protect oil and all this other stuff, right, is because they're protecting an old infrastructure. And this infrastructure isn't essential anymore. You know, it's like aging pipes. Come on, we're using combustion engines that are 150 years old. You know, the first combustion engines, steam engines, and all that shit, the idea of pushing a piston around, it's old technology. And we're way beyond that. But these guys would lose a lot of money having to move into a new technology. You know? People would lose their whole thing. And energy is never going to be a problem. There is more energy everywhere than we could ever possibly use. I mean, there's this material called methylhydrazine, which is on the continental shelf of every continent. And basically what it is called frozen methane. And the pressure of the ocean and the temperatures pull this stuff out. It looks like ice, and you can light it up and burn. And there is enough of this stuff to fuel us at our present rate for 50,000 years, just on the Earth alone, you know, let alone other renewables such as solar and all that other did, which are getting much more effective. But for all of these schemes to work, you have to decentralize the grid, because the grid will only operate on fossil fuels. So support something like renewables, support something like hydroelectric power, you're supporting the grid. You're supporting the fossil fuel movement even more than you would otherwise. Scary stuff. So we look at this chart here. We have this, I think you got my point, that the United States is a renegade nation. We don't want to deal with anybody on the planet. And this business with liberals and right wing and all that other jazz is just another fiction that could be as invented by Karl Rove as anybody else. These are not really the issues on the planet. Nobody's talking about the real issues on the planet, which has to do with allocation of resources, point blank. Other thing to note, the United States is no longer controlling economic power on the planet. China is. And particularly if you take a consortium of China, India, and Brazil, they dwarf both the United States and Europe combined.
India and Brazil. It dwarfs
the GNP of the United States and Europe combined at this point in time. Now, what has caused the run-up of oil prices in the last 2 years? China's demand for oil. China could not last year, could only achieve 75% of their oil imports. That was it. They were 25% short. And they couldn't pay the people. We need the oil. We want to buy the oil now. Because if they did, everybody would bid up the prices. Well, now they all know. They bid up the prices. Okay, you guys, you need the oil. We'll make you pay. Meanwhile, we still have long-term contracts, which is why it hasn't hit us here yet. Why was Germany and France so upset that we went to Iraq? Because they had long-term oil contracts with Iraq. They had gotten paid off by Saddam, and they had all their contracts, and they were fixed for oil. Britain had the North Shore oil. So they were fine about supporting the U.S. They know where their bed is feathered. But that's why Germany is mad at us. We took away their long-term oil contract. Just took right out. We walked into their house, opened their refrigerator, and took their Thanksgiving turkey and left. You know, and said, okay, what, you're upset? Well, screw you. Better keep quiet or I'll punch you in the mouth. That's our attitude. You know, you better keep quiet. We'll just punch you in the mouth. We'll send a couple of jets over to Libya and bomb the hell out of you. You know, so this is going on. It's China's thing, but China's the country to watch. China's really the country to watch right now. Because, you know, China is kind of like where the United States was before the crash of 29. No controls on their capitalistic currency, on their capitalistic system. The Chinese currency is not convertible. You can't take Chinese, what are they called, yuan or whatever they are. Yeah. No, reals, munis, yuan. Yeah. You can't take them and go out and buy a dollar with them. But they're indexed to the dollar. So if the dollar falls and gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, China gets happier and happier. That's correct. And if the dollar falls cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, large debtors like us, and remember they mentioned how Japan got wiped out because our dollar devaluated. And Japan's been in a depression ever since that happened. They never really recovered. You know? that this is one of our classic ways of getting rid of debt. We did this in the 20s. We got Great Britain to invest like crazy into the U.S. Like really, like man, into the U.S. And then we had the Depression. And it wiped out all the British investments. And as the British guys went bankrupt, the U.S. banks took these assets over and redistributed them to the farmers in the Midwest. They invested in all the farms and everything else. You know, and we had the farm collapse in 1925 preceding the Great Depression. And was one of the, they call it one of the contributing factors to the Great Depression, but it was really the key factor to the Great Depression. We're in a very similar situation with China right now. The guys in China figured out the trick that the guys in the United States figured out during the crisis with the SNL loan scandal, where essentially you have this idea that you can go out to the bank and you say, all right, I'm going to build a factory. I'm going to employ 10,000 people. And I'm building on this field over here, right? And look, I got the work permits, and I got guys going to sell me the field and all that stuff. Give me the money, and I'll build the factory. They said, hey, good idea. Here's all the money. The guy goes out, builds the foundation of the factory, and says, oh, I'm bankrupt now. I'll leave the country. This is happening in China like crazy, right? Not only that, you have a problem with imports and exports in China. China spends all their money modernizing their export facilities. But they didn't do a damn thing about their import facilities. Right? So you can get something manufactured in China and have it shipped to the port of Los Angeles in 4 days. In 4 days, you can have your goods coming in on a super tanker right out of the Chinese port, right into the U.S., right? 6 days at most. But if you send a load of scrap steel to China and go into their receiving port, you're stuck outside that port for 3 months at $5,000 a day. Now, it used to cost $20,000 to ship a load of steel over to China, right? But their demand is so high that now it's costing close to $250,000 to ship that same load of steel, right? Meanwhile, the company on the other side, the Chinese company, I imported a load of steel, right, and I've got this warehouse space on the dock. They finally get the ship unloaded, they get the stuff in the dock. All their competitors will say, sell me some of your steel, sell me some of your steel. And it's like, oh, okay, well, we really only need half of it. Let's wait a few days and see if they bid up the price. So they're displacing the warehouse space, doing run-ups on these commodities, and it backs up the port even more. And the railroads can't even get the stuff moved out fast enough. This is a problematic thing. This is how you lead to a collapse. This is a bubble. Everybody here is worried about the housing bubble and stuff like that. And I've been predicting that the housing bubble should have gone to shit when Saturn went to Cancer. Right? And I have these other people that are saying, oh no, Vedic astrology is really cool. That's when Saturn crossed the 0 degree Cancer in the sidereal system, in the Vedic system. Right? Oh, we've had a peak of the housing market. No, the housing market, they don't know what a housing market collapse is. You know, a housing market collapse is a real big thing. It takes a real long time. And you know, we're such smart Yankee traders, you know how we're going to avoid the housing collapse? We're going to make cheaper dollars. We're going to make the dollars worth shit. So that, you know, it'll be bad for poor people, but the rich guys will be able to eliminate their debt. And we'll eliminate all the bondholders overseas. Except for one bad problem. I think it costs us $3.8 billion a day to fund the U.S. government right now. You know, if we have to sell $3.5 billion worth of treasury notes, you know, debt service, debt instruments every single day, right? That accounts for 80% of the net income of the world. That's not sustainable. Already they had a very strange day in September, September 9th to be precise. And around September 9th, the U.S. Treasury had an auction and nobody came. Nobody did. You can raise them on U.S. Treasury securities. Yeah. And nobody came. And after that, it all went back to normal. They said, oh, well, this is an anomaly. But, you know, China's going to wise up. They've got a lot of money to spend. So is Japan. They're going to wise up. They're not going to invest in U.S. Treasury instruments if the dollar falls, and they're going to lose money on their investment. So they'll pull back. This will be the real crisis. So you're going to have a tumble in China, followed by an inversion in the U.S. Now, This is supposing that the U.S. is operating at full tilt boogie. But a few other things are going on here that not many people are taking advantage of or observing. One is natural disaster. In my original... prophecy for this period of time was that the United States went into mediocrity primarily because we were overextended in the world, and we had a series of natural disasters that reduced our ability to be involved in the world arena. Now, four hurricanes in Florida is a good example of such an effect.
So, 2000 elections.
Well, that's one way to put it. But the United States is volatile. North America's always been a very volatile continent, you know?
Yeah, and it's funny how Texas is like under 10 feet of water right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Waiting for what happened to Ohio.
Well, the Cascades, very important, right?
Aren't you there?
If we take into consider Florida, that what's the net effect of the hurricanes in Florida?
Tomatoes, $4 a pound.
That's right. And what's going to happen to our winter wheat crop, or domestic winter wheat crop? Also, same thing, vegetables, all the winter
potatoes,
stuff.
All of that. Florida's a big potato that nobody thinks about.
That's right. All of our winter foods are going to get just as much as gas shock, we're going to be getting a food shock very, very shortly. It's masked by the fact that we're importing food and stuff all over the place. But let's suppose now, like Mount St. Helens has shown increasing activity.
Rainier did too.
Rainier pulled a few rumbles. But nobody observed the mountain that's down, 75 miles from Guadalupe. There's a volcano down there that also has been blowing.
Oh, is it
Montserrat?
Yeah. No.
No, it's not Montserrat.
No.
It's one of those guys.
Oh, Central America.
Yeah. It's in Mexico.
It's right at the bottom of Mexico, because I lived in Central America back in the 70s, and that sector's been off and on all the time.
That's right. Well, it hasn't had a real big blow for 510 years, and they said that it's really showing strong signs, and nobody's paying attention. Well, midway between those two mountains on the Pacific Rim is Parkland, California. Or Parkview, where they just had a 7-point earthquake about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, that was out in the middle of nowhere. You know, a few groceries fell off the shelves, and that was about it. Let's take this a little bit further. We don't have to have California falling into the sea. Right? All we need is an earthquake that knocks out a few key infrastructure environments. A couple of bridges that take a long time to rebuild. Some railroad. We don't even need that stuff. A few railroad connections. That's all we need. We need a 10% slowdown in the movement of goods and services out of Port of Los Angeles. And boom, the United States is out of commission. Out of commission as far as the world market is concerned. So everything's going in and out of Port of Los Angeles.
Right.
You know, and they can't even keep up there. You know, that... You know, when we had that quake in Santa Monica and we had the quake in San Francisco, well, you know, everybody gets scared about these things. Oh, we're all going to drop dead in an earthquake or something like that. But bottom line is, that isn't what the problem is. The problem is the destruction of the infrastructure. And we do the thing in San Francisco and all that, well, the highway collapsed, you know, 880 collapsed. And then we did the thing in Santa Monica and we lost a couple of freeway bridges. But let's suppose that a couple of large bridges go out and a couple of railroad lines get disrupted. That really screws everything up. You don't need a lot of disruption to really cause large-scale problematics. So, if you own a house and you're paying a mortgage on $200,000 or $300,000, costing you $3,000 a month, right? Well, you'll be able to pay that back with cheaper dollars if you can continue making those cheaper dollars. What was the big deal in the Great Depression?
No jobs.
Right, 25% unemployment.
Right.
Right. But if you had a job, any job, you were doing great.
Right.
You ate.
It was like my grandparents, because there were 10 kids and the adults, they never felt the Depression.
Right.
His family felt the Depression in great quantity because they were money people and lost it.
Yep. Well, you got to remember now, that's what the shakeout is all about.
Yes.
And so you got these people that are billionaires, and they're going to shake out all the millionaires.
Yes.
We can afford to lose 20%. You know, but those other people can't. And that makes more resources for us. But this is not a conscious thing. It's not a conscious movement. There are other entities going on here. There are other entities involved.
Do you think it has to be like a quick period of disaster? Or?
No.
Because I think of like the global warming, we're just going to see more and more hurricanes and floods, and it's going to get a little bit worse every year.
But with the global warming, we keep talking about the hurricanes and that. The whole thing about global warming is the extremes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ice storms as well as the hurricanes that are going to kill us. People didn't move around New England with all the ice and stuff, and that was small.
Well, you have to understand things like with earth movement, natural disasters, and stuff like that. Humans don't have a problem with this.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. We really don't. That's why we're here. We're weed species. We can adapt to things. You know? I mean, why is it that we are the way we are? You know, the whole thing with evolution now has to do with the fact that we were built to run.
Right.
We're runners. That's why we have big butts and all that other stuff, because the apes have real small butts. They can't run a great distance. But we were able to run, and because of that, we had the balance with our heads, so our heads got bigger. Better balance point. Truly.
The newest stuff,
you know, is that this is the reason we've evolved such. So, global warming, sea level rise, people get displaced. You know, think about potato famine in Ireland. Boy, that was pretty bad stuff. What did they do? They left.
But that's the people. I'm talking about the structure. You can't move with ice.
The other thing about the structure, too, is as far as I'm concerned, you look out at that street and there's like macadam on the road and there's all these wires going by and stuff like that. That's old infrastructure. In the newer world, when all this particular period of crisis passes by 2012, 2013, it's rebuilding itself, by 2020 it will become apparent that if you have no infrastructure, you're better off than if you have an infrastructure. You have no infrastructure. So the infrastructure itself is going to be an impediment. It's like living in the Roman ruins in the 8th century. You know, what good did it do living in the shadow of the Colosseum? You know, it didn't do any good at all.
He took the wood and went home and burned it.
Yeah, pretty much, you know. But we can't do that with the wires and stuff like that, you know, or the mechanical. So I look at the infrastructure itself, you know, it's not worth preserving. You know, there is a large element of change about to occur. Now, in the end, this change will be very good, but the political method of getting there stinks. So you have this guy who's coming to power. It's accelerating in this particular chart. I'm sorry, I haven't done too much with it, but we will. It's accelerating with this particular chart. He's just a catalyst. He goes away. But the legacy is horrible. It's the after effect. The hangover. It's bad news. All right, so what are we specifically doing this year? Right. Here we have the United States. Meridian stands with Washington, 7th house, that Saturn is on the 7th house from the meridian. If I put the pointer on the midheaven, right, that would be the 10th house, 11th house, 10th house, 9th house, 8th house, 7th house, bam, nobody likes us, whoa, poor us, right, and that meridian is opposing the node and in half square to Mercury. Some serious stuff is coming out of the U.S. Right? Some seriously weird stuff is coming out of the U.S. But you look at Mars, and you see that Mars connects that midheaven to the cardinal axis, obviously connecting Saturn to the cardinal axis. Right? You look at this on the 90-degree wheel, right? It becomes even more so. Here's our cardinal axis. There's our Saturn axis. We do it this way. It looks a little bit better. Now, we just look at the midpoint of Saturn and Sun, right? We see it a little bit better here. When we see that Mars at the midpoint. That means that only the U.S., that midheaven, connects Mars. See, if we take the midheaven out of here, boing, gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have Mars essentially standing at the midpoint between Saturn and the world. And it's easier seen on this 360 here, right? We see Sun, we see Saturn and the cardinal. Now that's a bad picture for the world to begin with. This means that people die, people are disrupted, Okay, very, very big frustrations are going on. Everybody's mad, right? In general, how is it manifesting? Through the midheaven of Washington. Alright? Through the midheaven of Washington. So it's through that. So we see that how is the United States going to try and solve a lot of its problems? It's going to try and solve a lot of its problems through military means, through warlike means. Now that meridian, as I pointed out, Saturn runs with the Mercury. We look at the same thing here. There's the meridian for Washington, running in the half square to Mercury, Saturn Mercury time, right? Running with the ascendant by 22 and a half. So this is Washington. Either very thick and stupid, or real focused on the bottom line. Now we turn on the TNTs. We turn on the TNTs, right? We see that Saturn is half squaring Mercury and Cupido. Now, what Mercury Cupido is the commerce of industry. Saturn is delay. Saturn Cupido is the separation of the family. We minus Mars from the axis, you see that it equals Hades. Pretty precise. So we will be embarking on mass genocide. The Fallujah invasion, which I called, Sam called me up before the election, and we were looking at that, and I said, well, it isn't the election, it's right after the election. When transiting Mars comes down and squares Saturn, that will be a real drag, which is pretty much in these degrees, because at that point in time, we'll probably invade Fallujah, and we'll probably be engaging in a lot of genocide that they're not going to report in this country. And they haven't. They haven't reported anything. But two things have occurred since the election. One is that they're printing the names of the dead in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
They did not do that prior to the election. Because remember, we have a lame duck in office now. And two, they're showing pictures of the pastors, which was illegal to do prior to the election.
Well, a lot of things, besides that, now that the election is over, all of a sudden things have been vocalized.
Correct. And what kind of vocalization is this for the course of this year? Not too cool. Now, normally, Mercury and Cupido is singing and dancing, right? Mercury and Cupido rules singing and dancing. It's the happy group. It's the group. It's the debating society. It's to get together with talks. It's to get together to sing. It's a nice thing. But it stands with Mars and Hades, which means to murder, to kill. Right? So if we were to look at this picture, if we were to look at Mars, Hades, right, and subtract Mercury from the picture, right, and we look at our interpretation, criminal thoughts of murder, suicide, to think of activities causing losses and damage, abuse of words, cursing vilely, to have to deal with dangerously stupid people. Speech impediment.
What's a speech impediment? Nobody.
My lips move. Right? And we go to Mars and Hades, and we minus the midheaven from the axis, right? Able to commit mean acts or murder, to want to avenge oneself, an eye for an eye, to suffer or to be separated mentally through mean acts of others, be fed up, to have one's fill, quickly annoyed and weary, ugly deeds which bounce back, actions surprising.
Is that minus midheaven?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Many under difficult circumstances.
You know, I stayed up all night so I could go shopping early on yesterday.
Friday, yes.
And I was like passing out, and I had this weirdest vision of that something Colin Powell says or does is going to cause the whole administration to come tumbling down.
Well, he's a wild card.
The same picture minus Saturn, right, gives us murder by death or suicide, death by crushing, activity with many losses, work without pay, smoking, right? Mars, Saturn, minus Cupido, they're all on the same axis. To lose a husband by murder, death at social events, meeting of lowbrow people, activity with others in socially low surroundings. Goes on and on and on. And this whole thing also equals the ascendant for Washington. So when is what's the next big ding-dong going to occur? Well, it's going to occur in Washington, eye for an eye. Either it's going to come out of Washington or go from Washington. But it also means that this is the year to go underground. This is the year to duck and cover. because this is a year that the eventual leader is going to go after all of his perceived enemies, and it makes Richard Nixon's enemies look like play toys.
Yeah.
You know? Not a very good thing. Now, if we move this picture around to the ascendant, right, we look at the bottom here, and we have Neptune and Admetos. And if we connect Neptune and Admetos together, right, the general world comes into a new form of being. If we minus the ascendant from the axis, change intent in relation to the environment or to other people. Others experience a change in the environment. Others enter into a new form of being. What is that new form of being? Slow change of condition. The present condition starts slowly changing. A condition is sustained or preserved. Break up of the family or community. Change in living conditions for the worse. And finally, speeches, writings, opinions of thought about new forms of being. And of course, that whole picture stands with the Mars and Hades. And that whole picture also stands with Jupiter and the Moon. Which
could
now
have a lot of media reporting on all this.
Well, Jupiter and the Moon in general amplify things. It isn't necessarily a good combination. It amplifies things. Now, what's waiting in the wings here during the course of this year? Pluto's going to hit Hades. And what is the meaning of Pluto and Hades? It's a downward development. It's a lousy change. General decline. Symptoms of deterioration or decadence. General depravity and breakdown.
How long from now?
Very shortly. As a matter of fact, if we take this thing now and we start a step rate here of, we'll go in 7-day increments, right? Let's go ahead now. I'm going to go ahead in time, right? One, boing, boing. There we go. That is on 1/11/2/05.
Right before the inauguration.
Right before that. And if we go back one, you'll note that we get Mercury and Venus with all this other jazz right around January 4, which is when the Earth is closest to the Sun and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mars comes crossing over the cardinal by 22 and a half. So this is the combination. This is the combination of the year to watch, is that Hades and Pluto. That's one of them. The other thing to note as well is that Vulcanus and Apollon are breaking up, so that the great prosperity of the world now is becoming a memory. Saturn will be getting hit by the node soon as well. We go, again, step ahead. Look at that node. Watch the node moving backwards. And that will be by May. And that will not be a lot of fun either, because it runs with Vulcanus. So if you look, Saturn plus Vulcanus here is the people in general subject to strong hindrances and obstacles, and therefore have to watch for their opportunities or advantages, minus the node, to experience strong hindrances through one's connections, to be connected with people who are themselves or attentive, vigilant, and on guard. Guard spelled wrong. Oh, no.
No, you're right.
Looks weird in that typeface.
Yeah,
but you get the sense. You get the sense of what's going on here. This is all running with the cardinals by 22 and a half. All runs with the cardinals. All right, so those two things are going on. The main thing, however, is this one. Look at this Cronus and look at this Neptune. And as we move forward in time, weekly here, look at the Neptune, look at the Cronus. Look at the Neptune, look at the Cronus. Watch the watch. Right. Here's Neptune standing on the cardinals. Not the last time either. We go back. And then Neptune starts moving forward. What is that Neptune and Cronus doing this entire time? There's a little half square going on here. It's just a quadrate between the two. If we keep going forward in time, Neptune gets up to its point and starts moving forward again. Or backwards, rather. And again, we have that half square occurring. Here we are in July. Neptune crosses the cardinals again. and then comes forward. It stations at 1448, I think. Yeah, I think it's 1448.
Let me see.
There it is. 1449. The station's at 1449. Right, and then it comes forward. And oops, I'm sorry, going the wrong way. Just don't go. There we go. Now it comes forward, and it makes that last hit with Kronos here while Jupiter is running. And we're in January 24, 2006. So basically, throughout this year, Neptune and Kronos are running in half squares over the cardinal axis. And it's been running this way since Bush's election, originally. And inability in ruling circles. The general public lives under the wrong impression. It's kept there, so the wrong impression is increased. Okay? Now, minus Aries... Inability in ruling circles. The general public was in the wrong, kept the wrong, oh, she did this twice. Minus the sun. Get over there, you. That needs to be fixed. The failed manager. The man who is under the wrong impression, who is deceived, who plays a game of deception. Days on which the native is involved in deception or deceiving. So, you know, we've got this condition going on in the world. And this is the incompetency that's been there in the first place. In other words, this is like a bureaucratic managerial motion here. And it's like not too cool. You know, they're making bad policies, bad ideas, bad stuff going on. And we know all this. Come on, we're Northeasterners. Yeah. We're not living in Arizona. We're not, you know, in Iowa somewhere, you know. That kind of thing, there's nothing wrong with the people in North and South Carolina and stuff like that. I mean, except for the fact that they're not taking the time to investigate properly, they all these guys talk about the liberal media, then there's other guys talking about the agenda of the right wing media and all sort of this. I look at all media like I would be reading Pravda under Stalin. You know, to me, it's one big pack of lies. You have to look between the lines. Both sides. You've got to look between the lines. You know, discern what the hell is really going on. So, what did it do for us? It means you better be quiet. In that prophecy that I made in the 70s, was basically that when the no-good SOB comes to power, you have to be quiet and submit. Right? The United States will go to mediocrity. But then again, when the Roman Empire fell, the individual people living on their estates did well for many generations, for hundreds of years. It was a very interesting thing. When the first, one of the Visigoths, the guys came through, with the Huns, I don't know, one of those guys came through and invaded southern France, right? And all the Roman guys have had all these, farms out there and stuff like that, were like freaking out, oh my God, the Huns are coming, they're going to kill us all, you know? Kind of thing, but the Huns were sending emissaries out and negotiating with the landowners for their land. There's one Roman, I remember reading a letter from one of the Roman guys saying, well, you know, they were real fair. They gave me a good price for my land, safe passage, and I went to Spain. I bought more land. It was like these guys were real civilized. It was pretty cool. But yeah, historically, we see it very differently. Well, we're in a first world country, and I keep telling people, we're in a first world country. Even right here, we're in the Switzerland of the United States. And this is the Switzerland of the United States. This is where the money class actually resides. I mean, come on, for all Bush's business about having a house in Crawford, Texas, and all this other stuff, his family's still up there in Kennebunkport, Maine, and he was educated in Connecticut. You know, I mean, he's just as much of a Northeasterner as John Kerry was, you know. By the way, about John Kerry, this interesting thing there, side note, is Karen Thorne, the astrologer in Lincoln, she was the vice president of the NCGR up there for a long time. Well, her name is Thorne, and she was married to David Thorne, who was roommate to John Kerry, and John Kerry married his sister, Julia Horn. And back in 66, they had gotten a divorce a few years earlier, both of them, and Karen was telling me, oh yes, John Kerry, he's going to be the next president. He's going to run for president. This was a cold guy's ambition. He's all right, he's going to run for president. You watch. I've had too many barbecues with him. You know, he's going to be up. And you know, during the entire Clinton time, she was constantly getting invited to the White House. She was always down there having dinner with you know, we keep hearing about it going to the White House all the time. That, you know, it's just how small, you know, 6 degrees of separation with everything. It's really true. Well,
less than that around here.
Less than that around here is incestuous. You know? But 6 degrees of separation. So, you know, already back then, the ambitions were well laid out. But it was just another guy representing the same machinery. And I said, the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans are extremely narrow. And in truth, it's all masking something else altogether. You know? I mean, I saw the Bill Maher show where Mike O'Moore and Bill Maher got on their knees and were begging Ralph Nader not to run. How did you do this, Ralph? You shouldn't run. He got real embarrassed, you know. But in truth, Nader's the only honest guy in the bunch in terms of him saying it makes no difference. There's no difference between those two parties. I can't call myself a Democrat anymore. And Howard Dean, you know, he shut that guy right down. I mean, what was his problem? He had no problem. He basically wanted to renew the party reformist. He was a populist reformer. Boom, shoot him right down. You know, they got the blandest guy. I went to a lecture by the woman who was Al Gore's head of his campaign. Diane or Donna something? Something with G.
Brazil?
Brazil. Yeah, that's, yeah. She spoke here in Brewster. And at the time, there was like nine people running, and she basically said, it's going to be John Kerry who's going to run for the Democratic Party. And she says, the fix is already in. The other guy can't run. He's going to raise more money. He's already done all the backroom work. And she says, and besides, the good thing, he should be running. All these other guys aren't electable. Wait a minute. The theory that pervades there. So we're in a very strange place. And the advice basically is threefold. One, money. Money's been valuable during the course of this year. So what do you do? How do you protect assets? Right, what can you possibly do? You can't invest in paper like in the market. You can't invest in bonds. Don't run to gold. Gold will trade upwards. But you have to consider, gold is not the same as it was in 1981. You know, when inflation was going crazy and everybody bought gold and they bid it up to $800 an ounce before it crashed, even in 1981, gold was still a standard for a lot of other currencies. Now it's not at all. And it's just an industrial metal. And the biggest market for gold is jewelry. And if we have a depression, there is no jewelry market. And the industrial usage for gold has been dropping like a stone because they were trying to find all kinds of substitutes, but it's an expensive precious metal. Whether you invest in precious metals, and plus every person on the planet is going to flock to gold and bid the price up, so for a while there it'll shoot through the roof until nobody, you know, can buy it anymore, and it'll just collapse like a stone because it really has no intrinsic value, especially if people start having to get their gold future shipments to their door. You know, truck drives up, you own 2 tons of gold, you know. So what can you do? Excuse me. Well, in terms of that kind of area, the thing to invest in would be in things like platinum, which has a heavy industrial use and is scarce. You know, you spend so much time looking for gold, not enough time looking for platinum, chromium, any of the rare earth metals and earth elements.
What about the earth itself? What about land? What about real estate?
Land is way so overvalued in the United States. The only thing that's going to happen is there's not going to be a market. See, markets only work as long as there's demand. And nobody's going to buy land at these costs. Now, I know this because I've been in the land acquisition committee for the town. I've had $15 million to spend now for the last 6 years find land around here in Brewster, and let's just watch it. And it's just like incredible. You know, land is bubbled up by the demand. So on the Cape, land will not, the housing will not devalue more than 20 to 30%. But if you go out to Pittsfield or Western Mass or something like that, it's going to fall through the floor. Because there's no demand. There's no intrinsic demand for the land. It isn't finite there. Okay? The most important thing about land right now is housing itself. Make sure you have a roof over your head. If you're paying a mortgage, it better be a mortgage to your own house.
Right.
Not in a speculative sense. So using land as a speculation or as a holding device for funds, it will just erode your funds. The other thing you can invest in would be other currencies. You can't invest in bonds in other nations because they'll be subject to whatever the payback schedule is that's dominated by the dollar. But you can, for example, if you bought euros at 80 cents on the dollar, you would be a rich man right now. Because it's trading at $1.30. You see?
Yeah.
Even the Canadian dollar, which is trading at 60 cents on the US dollar, is now trading at 85 cents on the US dollar. You know, and that's pretty scary. So other currencies, and it means moving money, it means being an educated person and having to move your money around all the time. All the time. And not with the idea of a speculative venture where you're going to gain funds because of some investment, or I'm going to have this long-term investment from income. No, just keep your funds from eroding. Because that's going to be the big pressure. The deflationary spiral that started in 92 is finally going to be a bane in our existence. You know, you have to think, if China stops nominating their currency on the index to the dollar, well, that $17 DVD player that was on sale at Best Buy yesterday is going to cost $300 overnight. So, you know, goods and services and whatnot are phenomenally cheap to us. But the only reason they're phenomenally cheap is because the dollar is phenomenally overvalued. That DVD player that we're paying $17 for is still $300 in a third world country. You know, still unattainable good. And these guys are all fighting it out now here in the United States because we're the last viable market. Europe is in a malaise, but Europe in the long run actually has a better shot. I consider Europe as having one of the best shots to surviving this time. Because even though they're not going to grow economically, at least they're going to remain stable. Not a hell of a lot is going to happen in Europe. The rest of the world, a hell of a lot is going to happen. Right? A given. Right? Next, what do you do here in terms of personal survival? Join the Republican Party. Join the Republican Party. The way the prophecy went, the way my personal prophecy went, was that this guy dies in office.
Well,
he dies in office and he leaves no heirs. This is the thing, that once he dissolves, the coalition that put him together really won't know what to do. It's like the rest of this stamp, this Groff article, which Ray didn't give the rest of it, so he kind of cuts off here. But...
Oh, I thought it was all there.
No. But in the rest of the Groff article, he goes on to say that when he actually debates this right-wing neocon, the guy gets up and says, it's like this is after the election, and he's doing the campaign rap. Oh yeah, well, you know, we had to invade Iraq because Saddam was a bad guy. And oh yeah, Kerry would have been a lousy guy if we invaded Iraq. And he says it like four times. And once this guy Groff starts hitting with these other arguments, the guy shuts up. He has nothing to say. And he says he even got beat red when he brings up Haiti as a failed U.S. intervention. You know, it's like, well, if the United States isn't into nation building, well, what the hell are we doing in Haiti? Why are we in Haiti in the first place? Why did we throw out the Aristide government? The United States engineered that too. Yeah, and then we make it the worst place in the world, and then two hurricanes hit the place. And those people are screwed. I mean, they're screwed. You go 200 miles away to Grand Cayman, right, and same hurricane hit them. They got totally destroyed their infrastructure. They're doing just fine. You go across the border into the Dominican Republic. Right? They're doing just fine. Haiti's 5,000 people dying of flood. And it's just terrible because, you know, we're leaving this country dry, essentially. We don't want any nonsense down there. You know? Cuba will go through massive changes this year. One of the things about this Cronos and this Saturn is the dissolution of great world leaders, too. There is no leadership on the planet. That this guy Bush and all that did was like when you're the king character, you destroy anything that can challenge you. You know, and there really isn't any challenges to him on the planet. So Arafat dying, Castro will go away. We've had a big change of leadership in China. It just is taking effect now. Putin is consolidating his leadership. You can see the Saturn Uranus operating with the fight between Yashchenko and the other Y guy.
Oh, yeah.
The Y guy is over there. Right? A bunch of Y guys. Yeah, we're a bunch of Budinskis. Right? But you have all this going on in the world and no real positive leadership, and it's not going to be any. That's the other part of this year. Normally you have checks and balances. Normally you have guys like Rockefeller, no good SOB, in the back room, trying to control stuff. J.P. Morgan in the 1929 crash, sitting around buying up banks really rapidly, to prevent destabilization. Well, the old world view is that the world had to be a stable place. The new world view is not.
I mean, we've got a tiny little example here right now in Boston with the troops in the Bank of America. Who wants it? No, nobody wants it. Put money on it? No, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. There's not going to be a movement towards stability. Usually you get to see, once we upset the House of Cards, once we began invading sovereign countries without provocation, which was the case in Iraq. Now, even Afghanistan, Clinton did a couple of things correct. One was, Osama blows up the coal. What does he do? He sends a whole bunch of cruise missiles in and destroys the camp, tries to target Osama himself. Right? Not that Osama is Osama's only representation of a larger movement, which, by the way, what country, who was Iran for during the last election in the U.S.? Who were they writing editorials in favor of? Iran. Yeah, they were pro-Bush. You know why they were pro-Bush? He said he left us alone.
Yeah.
He said they invaded Afghanistan. Well, that was a drag, but he invaded Iraq. Those were our enemies. They killed 8 million of our people, right? So, hey, he's a good guy, so it's like, the minute we it was a smart move was to send in bombs, to send in specific guys. But even Afghanistan could have been justified, because we really didn't invade Afghanistan. All we did was throw a little weight to the opposition and allow them to have a successful civil war. We never put more than 11,000 troops in Afghanistan, through all that stuff that was going on. And we put them in on horseback, right. Nonetheless. We sent in people on horseback because we didn't trust the Afghani helicopters.
They were CIA.
We sent the CIA by horseback. They won the country. It was great. Right? But the bottom line, that was a mistake on our part, because we invaded a sovereign nation. Even though we didn't like the Taliban, even though they were doing things that the rest of the world thought sucked, and throwing up Buddhist statues and stuff like that, and doing real bad to women, it still was an invasion of a sovereign country. And even Reagan had that sense of restraint. He went and bombed Libya, but he didn't invade Libya. He bombed them. He shut them down. And they shut down. They stopped doing what they were doing, But then we go into Iraq, and this is an invasion of a sovereign country, and this is worse than Sarajevo setting off World War I. This is the dominoes coming down. And there's nothing stopping us from invading another sovereign country like France.
And doing America.
Let's take out the Eiffel Tower. Come on. Why are we screwing around, I like those paintings in the Louvre. I'd like to see them in the National Gallery. But it's really true. There is nothing, we are a morally renegade nation at this point in time.
France is too hard to hold on to. Whenever you go for France in the risk game, you're like,
that's right. It's a tough one.
You have to go for any of the high risk. Or you've been in Iran, you've been in Korea. you picked on little countries that have some use, but have
as Mr. Dossier puts it, you know, five superpower groups, naval groups supporting the transport of oil. We don't care where it's being shipped to. We just want to make sure it doesn't get disrupted. Well, yes, it's true. We go into that, and of course, and where's the next big fight over there going to be? Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia. There'll be a revolt by the Wahhabis, and it'll upset a lot of stuff there. I'm very, very surprised. Well, you see, Pakistan and India, I have been saying for a number of years, were sort of dropping nukes on one another because they felt that the world tensions there were very strong. And that could still happen. But this guy Musharraf, you know, he's like, he would be assassinated tomorrow. If he walked out on the streets of Karachi, he would be assassinated tomorrow. I mean, the people hate him. His own people hate him terribly. But, you know, he's signing deals with us real fast. And part of the deal was you better patch it up with India. But that was mostly, the Kashmir revolt was mostly supported by Pakistan. So Pakistan has to toe the line because they saw firsthand what we're doing. You know, and they said, okay, you're right. We'll join with you guys. We'll go with the winners. So the U.S. is going to prevail. Militarily, the U.S. is going to prevail. We're even going to win the insurgency that's happening in Iraq. Even though it's going to descend into civil war and stuff like that, we'll win. We're going to win all these fights and battles. You know, it really is true that the Palestinians, the most they could fight back to the Israelis was with rocks. You know, I mean, suicide bomb is notwithstanding, it's a new tactic. You know, relatively speaking, it's only 4 years old. But they basically, all they had to fight with in the 80s and 90s was rocks. Therefore, we've read about them in the news and everything else like that, but they were a suppressed people with no hope, period. While the rest of the world has got the same condition with us. Compared to our military, all they can fight back with is rock. That's it. So, militarily, we will prevail. But it doesn't mean that it's going to be a good victory. It's going to be a hollow victory. Because the whole condition, the apple cart will have been upset so much that all the conditions will have changed. You know, through the conditions with which we're going to be fighting with. So, for this year, in general, we got this Mercury running with Cupido and all that other jazz and Saturn and all that jazz. Sing and dance. Get out and party. Have a good time now. You're in a first world country. It's the last place where they're going to be partying.
Mm-hmm. I saw the partying. That's why I was like, oh, come on. Gary's going to see something else besides this big party that's going on.
Yeah. Have a good time. You know, Mercury, Cupido, Uranus. Hey, it's like spontaneous. Who's bringing the beer? You know? It's a nice thing. Look, it stands right near the cardinals and stuff. Because it will be one of the last times. The ascendant for Washington. Look at that Kronos. That Kronos pulled that ascendant right into the cardinal axis. With Apollon. This is the ruler who seeks glory. But of course, he is surrounded by days of idleness and vice. See, Zeus and Hades, right, is lack of coal. Oh, he said it wrong. This is wrong again. It's days of idleness and vice, you know, is that Zeus and Hades. And so the idea here is that you have a rulership here who's going to revel in their glory and get real complacent about stuff.
You already said it. I'm going to spend your money. He meant it metaphorically, but I think he was like, woo!
Could you look at the local chart, too?
From the Boston?
Because there was like all kinds of stuff going on with the Ascendant and the Midheaven. I didn't know what it meant, but it looked like it could be scary.
Yeah, he said Taurus at the fourth instead of Aries.
Okay, so basically, in this wheel here, right? Yes, we changed sign.
Right, that's the one I was.
Yeah, the local one here, right? The sun pops up into the 12th house. Well, essentially, the U.S. is going to ignore the Northeast as best they can.
He's going to punish us, you think?
Yeah, they're going to ignore us, pretty much.
The weather's going to punish us, too.
Mm. Look, is the moon on the bottom?
Oh, yeah, it's going to be pretty wet.
Very wet and very stormy.
It's not going to be as cold as last year.
You can read it in the sheet. Yeah, it's been a cold weather around.
Well, it's winter, and then it was, but it's not going like last year.
Now, if we look at the meridian, for the Boston area, right, we see that it stands at the midpoint of Sun and Uranus, equals the meridian here, and Mars and the ascendant, which indicates some sort of major accident of some sort will characterize the area.
Really? Not the big dig with a 1,000 leaks?
No. No, not the death by a 1,000 cuts.
This is going to be the thing, you know, like they built the pyramids and it's about why they did it. We're going to have the hole that nobody remembers why we did it because no cars are going to be in there.
Actually, though, one of the things I have noted about Boston since the Big Dig project opened up is that the town is becoming a single entity again.
Oh, it is.
You know what I mean? The connection between the North End and the rest of the town is actually growing. You see the tentacles literally just beginning to lash out all over the place. And it does work. It does work in terms of channeling traffic around. Now they have Sixth Borough Drive and Memorial Drive and stuff like that.
I thought it must have been looking at their own chart or something. I thought there's more stuff on the cardinal axis. Maybe it's the TMPs.
Well, if we throw the TMPs, other stuff does begin to occur. You know, here we get Hades running with Cupido, which indicates the fact they're going to cut us out of every piece of government funding you could ever think of.
As I said, we're going to be punished.
We're going to be really big punished here. Very big anger in this area and time. But see, Mars with ascendant with Sun and Uranus is an accident of some sort. Some disaster of an industrial nature occurs in this area that we're going to be obviously hearing about. And you get that meridian that runs with the Zeus. But this is pretty much, you know, the Boston corridor itself. So, but I'm not that concerned with it. I don't consider it that negative. It also means in some ways we're going to be the innovator of the area. You know, you've got to remember, most of the munitions that are being used over in Iraq are manufactured around here in Connecticut, in central Massachusetts and stuff like that. This is, you know, it's true. What is it? South Park is Littleton, Colorado. You know, and that's where they make the missiles, the aerospace industry. But we make everything else. You know, or import it. You know, we're controlling it. That's the one thing. The ascendant axis connects the meridian and Mercury, so news will be coming out of here. We will be looked upon from a news fashion. That will be important for the area.
How is that?
This is Saturn and Cupido and Mercury running with ascendant and the Sun for the Boston area. This is the changes that are going on. Remember that business with Neptune and Venus to change, to transform. So we're still connected with this Washington midheaven in this corridor.
Is Romney walking out?
No, but Romney's going to be in the news.
Yeah.
We do gain. The Boston area does gain. Sun runs with meridian on the Jupiter, but we get Saturn ascendant. So I think this is why the housing market here will not be as damaging as it will be elsewhere in the country. You know, I think that we'll get by with cheap dollars, but those people that bought houses in Atlanta, they're really going to be in trouble. And if we take ascendant moon, which is the populace, the local people, see, they're having a good time. Venus, you know, no, really. They're having a good time with Jupiter and Volcanus.
We won.
We won the series. That's right. We won the series. The
curse, that's all anybody can think of.
The curse is over. That's all they're concerned about with Boston. But we do have, on a subtle level, meridian moon stands with Uranus and Kronos, which is the southern intervention of the authorities. Now, this may have to do with the wind farm and Big Dig function.
Yes.
Because you do have Romney trying to throw out the head of the Turnpike Authority for no good reason. I mean, the guy wasn't even there when he built the damn thing. You know, who knows whether he's a good administrator or not, the Turnpike head. He's just got a bug up his behind about it. And you have the Meridian Moon here, which is the public works. This is public works. The Meridian Moon is public works. And it stands with noted Poseidon. All the truth comes out. Not too bad around here. Not that bad around here. The rest of the world is pretty grim. We go back to Washington and just start doing the same kind of pictures, you know, meridian moon for Washington, right? Well, we see the node is running down. And there's Kronos and Mars, right? So what's Washington going to do? They're going to beef up their security apparatus. Boy, Mars and Kronos is the guy with a uniform on, you know? And it stands with the node and stands with moon and meridian. We take, and we know that ascendant sun stands with that Kronos. We take, moon ascendant for the place of the people. Boy, we're really, you know, Washington gets weirder and weirder. The rest of the world thinks we're cantankerous, you know, and they're clear about it. Poseidon equals the sun on all of that stuff. So, what was it, when Sherry called me up and said she was coming to the talk, you know, and said, now, Gary, you're not going to talk about stuff that's going to make me depressed, are you? I said, well, Sherry, I can't do much about the world going to hell in a handbasket. you know, it's really true. Good things are the fact that we will be the victors. The disastrous stuff that's going to happen to the U.S. happens over the next 2 to 3 years. The decisions being made in this country are, if you thought that they were bad before and incompetent, that just gets worse. It's really bad. It's really incompetent. That stuff's really nasty. The rest of the world is really grim. But we will be suffering in a split between rich and poor. That will accelerate. We are facing an economic Armageddon that comes shortly after the new year. So lock in your interest rates now. And we're going to go through
the roof. Isn't that interesting that somewhere in the subconscious that they're even doing these car sales about locking your interest now, and then all your future cars will be at the interest rate? But it's a weird indication that somebody has a feeling out there to market it.
Well, think about it this way. Who is backing up all the cheap interest rates? Now remember, these are loans and bonds and stuff like that that you just don't, you know, they aren't short-term investments. You back a mortgage instrument or something of that nature, you're in it for 20 years, better than 10 years. Well, no, it turns to buying a bond.
Oh, yeah.
Turns to bonds. You're in it for a while. So basically, it's all the people that went into the bond market in the last 5 years are the ones that are going to get royally screwed. They've already put their money up. That money's already at risk when the stuff collapses. Because they're already, all those loans, they're going to be, you know, interest rates will be running at 15 points, and they're going to be collecting at the rate of 2 or 3 points their
right,
share.
Yeah, right. Like, CDs went way down.
Yeah, well, they're going to go up. They're going to go way up, you know. But the point is the money going to be worth anything in the first place? So we do have an economic Armageddon happening, and it's going to occur where the United States is going to be very, very poor because nobody's going to buy our treasuries. And that'll happen soon. It'll happen sooner than you think. That's in the early part of the year.
I listened to a German commentator on it because I like to listen to some of the American, you know, English versions of some of their news and that, and he was talking exactly about this in Germany. It was about the fact that if it was anywhere else,
We would have already gone. We've already gone. Artificially being held together. Now, the other thing to note is the Jupiter-Saturn square occurs later this summer.
Mm-hmm.
All right? If we go ahead in time here again, we go by our increments here. Right? Watch that Jupiter. He comes back. Oops. Right? Comes forward and he makes his run. He makes his run through Libra. See the Jupiter now?
Mm-hmm.
Almost weekly, he's moving multi-degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, bam, here we go.
Yeah, we're by it right there. Mm-hmm. By the next solstice.
And that's by the next solstice, we start happening, the Jupiter and Saturn. And look at where it is. Look at that axis.
Oh.
Not
that
a good thing.
Lady.
That Pluto Hades, and that's the first thing that comes in this January. So it comes in, the crash, so to speak, or the run-up occurs in January and February, but the effects take almost 9 months to peter out to where we are. 9 to 10 months to get to us. So it doesn't, that part, again, isn't a lot of fun. So be wary of that one. Of course, the next week, Mars goes through the whole picture. Makes it more fun.
So,
next year's going to be really depressing.
That's what it's like. Oh, I was thinking about that.
Thank you for sharing.
Interesting isn't always fun.
All right, questions about all of this stuff.
You know, it's a curse to say that you live in interesting times.
Hey, listen, at least we're in the latter part of our lives doing this thing.
Yes.
We are established. If you were 21 years old and trying to make a family at this point in time and facing these conditions, and your skill level was like basically that of a carpenter or something of that nature, even a holy carpenter, it's not a great
I mean, that's a good example of mine. How many times, I mean, I have a 30-year-old daughter. She's living with me because she can't survive. It's not because she wants to. And there's a lot of that happening out there. I'm seeing it with a lot of people.
You go
through. I have a question.
Yeah.
Pandemic.
Yeah.
I was looking through my material, George McCormick. He's a great weather forecaster. He also did diseases and covered things like that. And in his research, he said you need something like a Neptune Uranus or a Pluto Uranus kind of thing going on to have a pandemic. And I was looking ahead this winter, and I really didn't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you can tell just from the ingress. How bad it
would
be.
This year is not going to be too bad. It's not going to be, again, until we get to not the first pass of Neptune over the Cardinals. Here. September and October of next year.
Ah.
Yeah. Here's where it begins to really occur.
What's that, what is that,
Poseidon Admeto?
What is that?
That actually rules atomic energy. the general educational facilities, ideas meet with rejection in the general world, well, also rules the origin of atoms, the origin of light. Poseidon Admeto is the basis of culture, the beginning of culture. And here we have Neptune. And here we have Neptune where it's like kind of splattering away. And I happen to pick this day where the sun is reflecting Hades on that axis with Uranus at 22 and a half. So it's a nice day to pick these things out because Poseidon Mars is there, so people are going to have to be making moral choices. And this would be when the flu vaccines would come out. But it is true, the avian flu and all that other stuff again would start hitting next year. I don't think that the Pluto Hades is going to be an epidemical kind of destruction. I think that that's going to be an economic one, and that will set the stage later for other nasties to happen, because once you destroy the infrastructure, there are no institutions. Institutions are very frail things. People think that because something has been around for 25 years, 30 years, 50 years, that some magical hand is guiding it. But as we all know, having been worked with volunteer organizations one way or another at different times, that all of these things owe their existence to a very tenuous thread.
Oh, I'm bored. Walk away.
It's a very tenuous thread, and institutions can get overwhelmed very, very rapidly, very, very easily. So, pandemic? I don't think so this year, later in this year. We start seeing it next fall. And the groundwork, however, is laid now with all those Neptune passes at 15. Understand that as Neptune passes 15 degrees of Aquarius, that the sixth sign is a manifestation of material in the world. You know, if Neptune were going over zero Aries or zero Cancer, well, that would be like a view of the world. You know, the world's getting the idea of Neptune. Things are dissolving into what? Like, for example, Kronos goes up with Cardinals. We have the view of a great leader, right? Who has Neptune half square, so he's a lousy leader. But the Neptune, when a factor is going over 15 degrees or 6, it actually manifests in the material form. And Aquarius is the 5-11 house cusp of your horoscope. So it has to do with the movement of peoples and goods. This is where the Aquarius, that's why I say the trade relations with these various countries is going to be the trigger factor for a lot of the collapse, and the bubble will start in China. Because it's the trigger factor, it's going to be right there, it's already set up. And it's going to happen with their banks collapsing because of fraud, and the fact that their economy can't move because they can't get enough raw materials in. And you just think about it for 1 second. If China stopped importing for 1 week and just exported, the world would be in such deep doo-doo real fast. So when Neptune goes over 15 of Aquarius and is moving their business and all its other jazz as being the central focus, it also tells us where the conduit is for the next series of illnesses and what's going on here, and that these things are an important thing. It also tells us the poisoning of the earth, the ecologi situation. It's very, very clear. Now, the earth doesn't give a hoot about poisoning. It really doesn't. It's just there. It'll just make something else. We do. It's our own ecological niche that we're hurting. But then again, we're a weed species. You know? Look at kids living in a ghetto. You know? I mean, they're living in a toxic wasteland, but they survive. Not very well, but they survive. You know, we're a weed species. We live where everything else dies because of our nature. You know? So, the ecological suicide of the world, the ecological genocide of the world, also becomes manifest much more next fall. But all the seeds, Neptune always projects the future and lets you know. The con man tells you he's going to con you when he's taking your money. That's part of the confidence game. He says, oh, you can't, you know. You know, he says, yeah, you're right, I wouldn't do that either. You know, that kind of thing. That Neptune telegraphs in its own way. Telegraphs information in its own way. And so we see all these seeds going on. The thing with Neptune is we ignore them. We ignore it. We don't want to face that new reality. So, how do you get through? How do you survive? How do you do all this other stuff? Well, the bottom line is this. If you're a late cardinal person, you know, a lot of factors in late cardinals, then this early part of this year is really tough. If you have material in early six, the latter part of the year is going to be pretty tough. If you have a lot of material in the middle of the mutables, you're getting ready for a roller coaster ride.
What about your mutable?
Well, that's the Uranus. And if you're in a late mutable during the course of this year, conditions are turning downward. They're not, you know, they're improving if you're up to 23 degrees of mutables. If you're after that, there's a possibility a lot of things turn downward. If you're early cardinals, the early part of this year is very good. The early part of this year is very good. Any other questions?
I have another one.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Gemini.
Hey.
Happy
full moon. Yes, full moon.
Space travel, this company that is $110 million and they're going to have public transport in the years to come, which I think is horribly exciting, terribly exciting, I should say. So, if I had the money, I'd go. What does it look like? Is there a picture for that?
Well, you look at Mercury, right? And we get the half-square Saturn, you know?
Okay.
And we had that whole thing, that whole space shot occurred in the last couple of months, right, where we had Saturn and Uranus standing on the cardinals, which is innovation, but one shot innovation.
Yeah.
So they're not getting off the ground. They're not getting off the ground.
Wouldn't Jupiter being, you know, breaking, going beyond the boundaries?
Well, it helps, but we don't really get off the ground per se,
okay.
In the early part of this year, when transiting Jupiter gets down to that area where Saturn is now, it might make it a little bit better. I believe that space travel has to do with Neptune, Pluto. No, Neptune, Zeus. Mm-hmm. It's a rocket motor. Right? And see, that Neptune and Zeus picture is standing near this Mercury Cupido. Mm-hmm. Now, Neptune was further back, and so was Zeus, when Bert Rutan's rockets went off and would have been hitting the Mercury of this chart. But my sense about it is that it all gets eclipsed by other stuff, and it all gets delayed. They really don't get going until after this period, anyway.
Mm-hmm.